disclosed she, her pronouns, and I am the chair of the CRC. This is our, This is our August 5th, 2020 meeting. We're going to go ahead and have the panelists introduce themselves. And for folks in the audience, if you can introduce yourself via the chat and say your name, any group affiliation, and what part of Portland that you come from. So Candace, chair, Northeast Portland, and Taylor, if you could go next.
Taylor Snell, member, coming from Southeast or Selwood.
Hi, I'm Julie Falk. I'm a CRC member in Southwest Portland.
Go ahead, Dana.
I'm Dana McCauley. I'm the Deputy Director of IPR.
Adam?
Adam Green, member, Southeast Portland, Woodstock.
Sylvan?
Sylvan Frazier. I use they, them pronouns. I'm a CRC member, and I'm in Southeast Portland.
Vadim?
Hi, everybody. Vadim Mazursky, Vice Chair, Southwest Portland.
John?
Jihan Nami, CRC member, Southeast Portland. She, her, her.
Andy?
Andy Chiller, CRC member, Southeast Portland. She, her pronouns.
Irene?
Irene Konev, Independent Police Review, Community Outreach Coordinator. She, her pronouns.
David?
David Nguyen, IPR staff.
Brian Parman? You're muted, Brian.
Hey, Dick, I know how to run this. My name is Brian Parman. I'm a commander with the police bureau.
Cliff, I can't pronounce your last name if you can help me out.
There we go. Cliff Bacigalupi, I'm the captain with internal affairs.
Great, thank you. And then Chief Lavelle.
Hi, everyone. Chief Chuck Lavelle, Portland Police.
Are you sure you're not Space Police?
Oh, some days I wish, Candace.
All right, thank you, everybody. And again, for folks that are watching, please use the chat box to say your name, any affiliation you have, and the part of Portland that you're coming from. And I will talk in a second here about what our virtual guidelines are gonna be, just because now we're gonna be moving into doing conference hearings and appeals virtually. I wanna make sure everyone's on the same page as far as what are the expectations. So moving on, as far as the agenda today, we have appeal, a conference hearing on the appeal 2019-C-0144. Before we do that, we've got a couple of minutes. We'll hear an IPR report. Those are a lot of R's. And just 5 minutes, please. And I have a CRC chair report also for 5 minutes. And then I'll go over some ground rules in a sec. And then we'll jump in. So as far as the ground rules, so we are using the webinar feature so that we can control the room better. So folks that are out in the audience, you're automatically muted and without video. We will periodically turn the chat box on and off. It's currently on. Once we start going into the hearing, we will turn it off and then we'll open it back up again for work group updates and public comment, and we will save the record of the chat. If you want to raise a point of order while the chat box is off, and members of the public can raise points of order, and raise your hand and I'll call on you, please don't abuse that and raise your hand because you just want to say a comment. This is the best way right now we can figure how to make that available for folks that if we're not in procedure and somebody wants to raise that to us, please raise your hand and then we'll figure it out. And then all of our meetings are recorded with a couple of exceptions for our records, and non-appeal meetings will be broadcasted on Facebook. So this is considered an appeal meeting, so I'm not broadcasting it. And those also are due to exceptions that can be made by the CRC members via vote if necessary. So if you have any questions about any of that, now's a good time to say it in the chat real quick so that we can figure that out as we're trying to get the nuts and bolts of having virtual hearings. Okay, so we need to approve some minutes. We've got June 3rd and July 1st minutes to approve. Maybe let's do them one at a time because I know not everybody was here for both. So we'll start with the June 3rd minutes. Can I get a motion to approve those?
I'll move.
Sylvan moves and Jihan seconds it. And then I will take a roll call vote. I'm trying to figure out a good system for this. Now I'm going to write it on my paper. Just so I can keep track. Okay, so Taylor, your vote.
Approve.
Okay. Adam.
Abstain. I was not here for that meeting.
Okay. Sylvan.
Approve.
Vadim.
Approve.
Jihan.
Approve.
Andy. What did you say, Andy? I missed it. You're muted.
Sorry, third time's a charm. I abstained, I wasn't present.
Okay, thank you. Julie.
Abstain.
Okay, I get everybody. Oh, and then me, yay. All right, so with a vote of 5-0-3, those minutes are approved. Now let's move into the July 1st minutes, and I'll take a motion for those.
I move to approve them. Second.
Julie moves. Adam seconds. All right. Taylor, your vote.
Approve.
Adam.
Approve.
Sylvan.
Approve.
Vadim.
Approve.
Jihan. Approve. Andy.
Same.
Julie.
Yes.
And then me approve. So that with a vote of 7-0-1. That passes. Okay, so now we'll go ahead and go into the director's report. Dana, I'm assuming that is you giving it today. And you're muted, but your hair looks great.
Thank you, sorry. Okay, yes, it is me giving it today. So we're continuing under our COVID operations plan where our investigators and analysts and everyone is working largely from home with a few exceptions. For administrative purposes, people are visiting the office, but we don't have very much of a public interface right now, other than through phone, email, and the internet. So none of that has really changed since March. Our caseload has gone up a lot. And since May 29th, we have gotten 191 community contacts. 113 of those contacts are related to protests and protest events. And that also does not count several thousand, like over 2,000 form letters and general contacts that we've received where, you know, maybe people call and say, you all need to get control of the police or something that's not, you know, a very, very specific complaint about the police, but just, you know, people calling from Las Vegas to say Portland police have issues and things like that. So of the 191 contacts that we've received since May 29th, we've opened 51 investigations so far. And that kind of screening work and triage remains in progress. We've kind of had to shift to a triage process so that we can get urgent cases priority and then working to keep other cases moving. And we've moved around like some of our pod duties where there's a person of the day who responds to phone calls and emails that come in. And so we've kind of shifted our operations around to try to create a little bit more efficiency, but bottom line, we're still swamped. So we had a policy review that was released today with regard to the weapon flashlight policy. And I don't know if anyone had a chance to take a look at that, but it relates to the use of flashlights, which are attached to weapons. And the policy review outlines why that could be problematic and offers some suggestions. So I would encourage everyone to take a look at that review because we're really proud of it. We were, as you all know, engaged in a recruitment process, and the recruitment process closed on Friday. As you are also aware, there was a vote by City Council to significantly modify Portland's police oversight process or police oversight system on Wednesday last week. And so what we have decided to do is to kind of pause the recruitment process. We don't think it's fair to new volunteers to onboard them into a system that might not exist, or we're not sure what it would look like. And so we are going to be communicating out to the applicants that, you know, of course, we always appreciate when people are willing to volunteer and participate in this process. But right now we just need to get a little bit more information about what the future is going to look like before we try to bring new people into the system. That being said, I think, you know, I will say to you all also that we'll try to be as transparent and open as we can about where things stand right now. We don't have much information because we haven't been given much information. So I think that listening to the city council, even among the people who voted on the ballot proposal, there are different concepts of what IPR is supposed to look like moving forward. And so, I don't know. We could all see being here in November, who knows? I don't know what that's going to look like. And so that ultimately has created a great deal of kind of ambiguity for our staff and our operations. So I would just, again, say we'll try to be as communicative and upfront as we can about where things are moving forward, but we don't have a lot to share right now. And I would encourage you all to keep in communication as you have questions or concerns. I think that Ross and I have always been open to talking with you all about questions and concerns, but I think also are trying to figure out how to keep our staff from feeling slapped in the face by what happened, because honestly, that's really how that felt. So we're kind of working on supporting our staff right now, as well as keeping them, you know, they're all committed to the work that they're doing. So keeping the workload moving, and we've got this really profoundly heavy workload right now. So that's a thumbnail sketch of where we are with recruitment and everything. So things are kind of on pause, lots of ambiguity and lots of, I don't know. And then you can see in the report, our caseloads for June, July, and up to August 5th. And our current open investigations, two of those actually were turned in earlier this week. So there's only 7 independent investigations right now. And the PPB's caseload is on the report for your review. And then there was an update on officer-involved shootings. There's one that's in investigation right now, and that was the one that happened in June. And the other two are at review or debriefing. So that's the sum of my report.
Thank you, Dana.
Yep.
Okay. So my report, a couple of things to note. So we obviously kind of going off of what Dana said, there is a lot of uncertainty about what the next steps are going to be. We talked about this at our retreat last week that we were doing as the vote was taking place. Definitely the sentiment that I feel I heard in the retreat was that folks want to take a step back and take an assessment of what are the things that we're taking on, and making sure that it puts us in a place where it's productive to fit into whatever is coming next, so that we're not working within something that might not make sense, but that we still want to continue to hear our cases, continue to, you know, make recommendations on things, and be a voice at the table in which all those discussions will be happening on the next, what happens after this. So that is the current state of the CRC. I will be, like I mentioned last week, we'll try and see if we can set aside some time here and there to go back and do the things that we didn't get to, because there was a lot we weren't able to discuss. So we'll test that out later today and see if we have some time, and if not, we'll figure out a new plan, but I'll work on getting that together. Vadim and I have met with the mayor, and I also want to check in and make sure that people are sending emails to their commissioners. I sent that intro email a couple weeks ago. Make sure that you go ahead and follow up, and your trio groups sign up to meet with your commissioners. I got an email back from a Amanda Fritz saying thanks. We're looking forward to, you know, hearing from our group or our members. So if you have not already done so, please get together and figure that out and get in touch, because they are waiting to hear from you. We talked with Amanda a lot of what we talked about, ballot measure, you know, a couple days before the vote. And, you know, he asked our questions and our thoughts, so we, you know, went about that. And then we had a meeting with the PPB chief, Lavelle, the mayor, and some of his staff, and PSEP, co-chairs, TAC chair, and me and Vadim. We all met, I guess it was last Monday, to kind of just get some grounding and figure out where we all were, how we felt about the issues, just to get a baseline understanding of how we were all approaching everything that is going on. So it was really an intro conversation with a commitment at the end to continue to meet and discuss. So we're working on planning another meeting, and we want to meet every 3 weeks. This is also related to what we talked about in our CRC retreat about wanting to figure out how we can be better partners with these other groups, where one big thing that we talked about was if PSEP is doing a lot of the policy making, you know, work, can we partner with them and say, hey, you know, let's tag on to this, or, you know, let's work together on this, so that it doesn't, because the CRC has this really big responsibility, which is hearing cases that takes up a lot of our time. So that way we're feeling like we're having good partnerships and not like, oh no, we're not doing enough because we're not able to get to all the policy things we want to. I think there's other groups that are doing a lot more of that policy work, and we can partner with them and do things together. So that was kind of what came out of the conversation, and is what led to that meeting that we had last Monday. So we'll keep everybody informed. I know Shayna had mentioned last time too about people wanting to be more involved. Absolutely. Vadim and I, obviously, as your leaders of the group, have taken that on because that we see that as our role, but we're definitely open to having other people come to those tables too if you'd like, and we want to invite, you know, TAC and PSEP. So we'll figure out what that looks like moving forward. But if you do have an interest in that, just let me know. I think that is it for my report. So we'll go ahead and move into the conference hearing. Yes, unless there are any questions on Dana or I's report. Okay. So, you know, I know there are a bunch of new folks here that were not at this appeal hearing. And I also was not at this appeal hearing, so I had to go back and make sure I read the case and then read the minutes and everything. So we'll figure out how this works. I mean, what I understood from David, because I inquired, like, how does that look like? You know, can I vote, et cetera? Yes, you can vote as long as you reviewed the files. But obviously, I feel like the conversation might be a little different because I have no idea how people who were not on the appeal feel about the original CRC challenge. And so we'll work that out with Chief Lavelle today, okay? Per the process, so that everyone knows what we're doing, our two options today are that we can agree with the PPB chief as to their appropriate findings, and then the appeal will be closed. Or if we disagree with anything, then the IPR director would need to create a case for a hearing for the city council to make a final decision. So those are the two things that we will walk away with today. And like David said, you all have your files. We don't have the binder for you like we normally do in person, so make sure you have your files up. Okay. So, and please, David, as I'm doing this, or Dana, procedurally, because this is my first time running the conference hearing, let me know, interrupt me if I'm not doing it correctly. But I think from this point, what we'll do is I will state the original finding. So it was originally that Officer A would not take a vehicle theft report from the appellant, and this was under procedure and directive 630.61, stolen vehicles, and the original finding was exonerated. But after the hearing, the CRC voted 4-3 to challenge the finding to make it from exonerated to sustained on that first allegation. And you all, the second allegation was unfounded, and you all agreed that it was unfounded. So we are not dealing with that allegation today. So has any CRC member present not reviewed the complete case file and the minutes from the appeal hearing? Okay, good. So then everyone can participate and can vote. Okay, so first we'll give PPP command staff the opportunity to advise the committee of any concerns or disagreements that they might have with respect to our recommendation. Then we'll have IPR talk about, we'll have the opportunity to discuss any opinions or concerns about the disagreement between the committee and the police bureau. And then we will have a discussion with the police bureau to see if we can reach agreement. And then we'll do the vote and act accordingly. We do also take a public comment before the vote. And so David, since we're about to move into this part, can you go ahead and disable the chat?
Yep.
Thank you. And when you disable it, is it, does it disable for all of us on the panel too?
No. I think you and I are still able to send messages.
Okay, great. So we will go ahead and begin with PPP command staff. I'm assuming Chief Lavelle, you will be presenting the letter and discussing what the contents are, and then anyone else from command staff can jump in. But this is your time to present to us.
All right. So this is my first one of these as well, Kansas. So we'll be on this journey together. But I was thoroughly briefed on this, read through the summaries, and where I came down in this situation, looking at all the facts, is I landed on a not sustained with a debrief. I know the previous was exonerated and then the CRC finding was sustained, but I came in with not sustained with a debrief. And the reasoning is, I feel like with what was presented to the officer at the time, he would not have been able to actually verify proof of ownership and be in a position where he could have taken that stolen report. I know there was some dispute over what was presented, but even in the complainant's statement of what was presented to the officer, that would not have allowed him the ability to take a report because it's not considered acceptable proof of ownership by DMV. So I felt like it's not proper to sustain him on something that is not outside of our directives, but I do feel there's potential for a debrief to talk about maybe some additional follow-ups or questions he could have done, maybe attempts to contact the complainant back that would have maybe prevented the complainant from ending up in a situation where her vehicle was towed and she incurred those fees.
Okay. Does any of your command staff have anything to add?
I don't. I'm sorry, I had to unmute myself.
Okay. Cliff says no. Brian, I'm assuming you were saying no. If not, tell me, but we're going to move on.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Chief Lavelle. So I muted myself, sorry. Thank you, Chief Lavelle. Now we will take any questions that people have right now for the chief. Go ahead, Vadim.
Hi, Chief Lavelle. So for the debrief, what would that entail? Is that directly with the officer or with DMV or something altogether different?
No, I think there's probably opportunity for both. But I think from the officer's perspective, there's probably some discussion about what the officer could have done as far as follow-up, asking additional questions. Maybe the complainant didn't have additional paperwork, but at the time too, I believe she said she would call back with additional information and that didn't happen. Maybe there was an opportunity to follow up with her to see if she had gained additional paperwork or things of that nature. But also, you know, DMV is a process that we don't control in the police bureau. So, you know, some of these documents from DMV, you can just go in and pick up, fill out and not even take to the counter, but get a carbon receipt also. So it's not really indicative of a process that's in process with DMV. Some of these are just receipts that, you know, anyone could could receive, sign, and take with them also. So I think there's potential follow-up with DMV, but we don't really have as necessarily any control or leverage over what they will accept as a valid proof of ownership.
Right, because during our last meeting where we discussed this, even the people that voted that the officer was in compliance still felt some reservations about that time lag between when a person would buy a vehicle from an individual, not from a car dealership where they get something on a letterhead or otherwise, but from an individual. And unless they knew to get it notarized, it would take about a month or something like that for the DMV to actually send them their registration. And during that time period, if a vehicle becomes stolen, what would their options be? And I'm sure that in a debrief, you can talk about a dialogue that could ensue. But you know, there seems to be some lag during which if a car is stolen, certainly might not happen very often, but stolen during that time period, people wouldn't be able to prove that they were the correct owner of that car.
Yeah, that's understood.
Chief Lavelle, I have a question. I was one of the people who voted in the initial proceeding to change the finding to sustained. And it was really for three reasons. One, as Vadim alluded to, that there is a situation where someone who has a stolen car is left completely without recourse because they don't have documentation where they can file a stolen police report. But the two questions I have is, one, first, there was testimony at that hearing that the document that the appellant had was in fact the document you received at the DMV when you initiated the transfer of title. So the wording of the directives in B, it says, provides documents from the DMV indicating process of transfer of title. So it would seem to me that that is a pretty broad statement. And if there is a way for the officer to interpret that broadly to allow someone to have recourse if their car is stolen in that window of time, that would be the correct interpretation of that directive, that there is a document from DMV that indicates this process has started. And that leads to my second question. Even if there was a question about whether or not that document she had actually was proof of the beginning of that process, which is the words of that directive, subsection H says that in situations that do not meet that criteria, the officers must contact a detective or sergeant for authorization to accept a reported stolen vehicle. To me, the second part where this officer really failed the appellant was she had documentation. There was some indication, there was some proof, even if it wasn't sufficient under an interpretation of that directive, she had a document saying this was my car, is going to be my car. I think where that officer failed was failing to push that up the chain. And if the situation was where he got in touch with a detective or a sergeant or raised it at the flagpole, and at those various levels, they all said, no, this doesn't suffice, I would think that that officer had followed this directive because he complied with the portion of the directive where he should elevate it and then it wouldn't be his call anymore. So why wouldn't subsection H of this directive come into play? Why wouldn't this officer have the obligation to get another opinion or raise it to a sergeant or a detective and have them make that call?
Yeah, they might, but I think in that situation too, if DMV doesn't accept that as valid proof, you could end up in a situation where, you know, someone fills out that paperwork and even in your good faith effort to, you know, take that report, you could end up in a situation where, you know, that vehicle is not owned by the person who takes it. So I think it puts the officer in a predicament too. And even if that were elevated to a sergeant or detective, I don't know if they would have come to a different conclusion. Although I do see your point though.
I think for me, when I think about like whether the sergeant would come to the same conclusion or not, I think the directive, the spirit of it to me is just that if they don't know, they need to ask. And I think that is, you know, that's something that I am expected to do, right, in my job. Like, if I don't know something, then I need to ask my boss and I need to clarify and make sure I'm giving correct information. But then once I cut that off, that person that needs information, I've now closed that channel, and I'm not even sure that I'm giving them the correct information. So that's, for me, after reading the case, I feel like that's the spirit of it. And that's why it's important to recognize how, you know, the police, you know, the first level of police, first responder, whatever you want to call it, they can't be the gatekeepers for what, you know, for the process. You have systems and chains of command for a reason, and people really depend on that. They depend on getting good information. So I feel like that's at least what I'm hearing Andy say in her argument. And I feel that's my argument too for why it needs to be taken more seriously.
Yeah. And I think that would definitely be part of the debrief as well too. I feel like this is a situation where the officer probably could have done more in the way of follow-up and checking.
Jihan, I saw you unmuted for a second. Did you want to go?
Thanks. Hi, Chief. My question is, what would be the appropriate documentation that the police bureau would accept under that provision B, the complainant provides documents from DMV indicating process of transfer of title? In all of the hearing last December, I think it was, I never really understood what was that documentation that was expected, and why a document from the DMV that is stamped by the DMV wasn't sufficient to fit under that definition.
Yeah, I think typically for us, and there's probably a host of them, but the most common would be a registration, a notarized bill of title. Those are probably the two that would be most commonly accepted. But I mean, there's probably a host of them without looking at actually any DMV paperwork or anything. I'd say those are typically the ones that we would encounter.
But as we've noted before, it does take a while for the DMV to actually send you the registration. So in that, in the meantime, what am I supposed to show to prove transfer of title or my intent to transfer title?
Yeah, in the meantime, it's kind of like Vadim alluded to. It's probably kind of a nebulous area. I mean, we're kind of tied to what would be accepted as proof of ownership. So, I mean, there could be that window of time where, you know, there's some gray area there, I suspect.
And that was the point that I think was brought up at the original hearing as well, where if you have a gray area and we did discuss the reason behind the restrictions on taking a stolen vehicle report, and that it could be used offensively and people can make false reports and it poses a danger. And we understand that. But you have the situation where you have a hypothetical person down the road who might suffer some hypothetical harm versus an individual talking to an officer who has actually suffered an actual harm. And that gray area, I just don't think it is a reasonable interpretation of this directive to have that gray area benefit the hypothetical person and harm the actual person. The interpretation that the benefit of the doubt should go to the person who is holding a piece of paper stamped by the DMV says, like, this is the process. This is what I went to the DMV, I did what I was supposed to do, and this is the only thing that I got. And then this car was stolen, and now I can't, and now I am out. I have no recourse whatsoever. And I have lost the car. I've lost the money. I can't get it back. I can't get it out of the tow lot because I have no proof. Like, I can't provide a stolen vehicle report. There was this parade of horribles that happened from this real person who suffered a real harm. And the officer's actions in that moment prioritized a hypothetical harm. And I just can't reconcile that interpretation of this directive is, and it's that was my reservation. That's why I felt pretty strongly that the officer violated this directive, that a fair interpretation of subsection B would look at the document that she got from DMV and say, yes, this is a document indicating the process of transfer of title. And if there is a gray area of what that means, it should have gone in her benefit. And that's why, you know, I voted the way I did, and I still believe that it should be sustained for that reason.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I get your point where you're coming from. I think still for me, it's like, that. To me, the issue in this case is really more on what the DMV would accept as proof. I think, though, the officer probably could have done more follow-up, or at least could have attempted to work with the complainant more to figure out, you know, how do we, you know, overcome this, you know, documentation issue. So that's why I ended up with the debrief.
The directive doesn't say what the DMV would accept. It says the complainant provides documents from the DMV indicating process of transfer of title. And do we all agree that the complainant did provide documents from DMV indicating process of transfer of title? That's a question. Do we agree that that happened?
I believe at the hearing, the appellant testified that that document that she got was the only document that you receive from the DMV when you start that process. So I see this document as proof of starting the process of transfer of title. It's not a title, it's not a registration, but it is, I think it is sufficient. And then I believe the appellant's, I think she also testified that they went back and went to do the process over again and asked someone at the DMV and confirmed that the document she had is the only thing that they get when they start the process. So to me, I think she proved that that is a document showing the beginning of the transfer process.
But I guess I'm asking PPB also, do you feel that the complainant provided documents from DMV indicating process of transfer of title?
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
So I don't have the paper file in front of me, and I know that maybe Commander Parman has those things. The officer made contemporaneous notes in the CAD thing in the CAD section when he cleared the call, saying that there wasn't appropriate proof. What I think she provided was the notice of transaction submitted. And even on the notice of transaction submitted, it says right on the note itself, this notification is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute an assignment or release of any interest in the vehicle. And so that in and of itself, I think that was part of the problem, is that the that in and of itself, and then you go to our directive and it says that, you know, you're in possession of the title, or you're the registered owner, obviously by per DMV.
But what about B, where it says indicating the process of transfer of title?
I want to make sure that I'm looking at the same thing that you are.
Yeah, and while Captain Bacigalupi is looking at that, I have the paper file in front of me, and the officers made contemporaneous notes about not having only having a bill of sale, and then when was interviewed. His response was that there was no title transfer, no registration transfer. I think all she, referring to the complainant, had was like a handwritten bill of sale. And so the evidence in the record is, it's unclear what exactly was shown to the officer, but the notes at the time and then his interview later indicate that he didn't believe that he had seen the notice of transfer. And then I think it's also important to note, as you review the directive, that is a list of things, and I think you have to refer up above in section 131 where it says one or more of the following may establish proof of ownership. That list there, you know, the goal of any investigation is for us to clearly establish who owns the vehicle so that we know that we're taking a valid stolen. And the list provides the types of documents that people might be able to provide, but you know, simply possessing this one notice of transfer, yes, it is on the list. But the qualifier above the list says one or more may establish proof of ownership. And I think the evidence in the record has established that the notice of transaction in and of itself does not establish proof of ownership.
Well, and there's also a question as to whether or not that was provided on the night. I mean, I see the conundrum that everybody's looking at here, and it's a tough deal. And I think on our part, the proof of ownership is, it's intentionally a high barrier because, and we talked about this before, and I know there was varying feelings on it, but stolen vehicles get stopped in a different way than somebody who ran a stop sign. And so we want to make sure that the vehicle that's being reported stolen, that we have a significant amount of confidence before that's entered into the system, thereby triggering a stop, hopefully at some point, to return the person's vehicle. And so to me, those are the things that kind of make this case difficult. And I put myself in the shoes of the victim on this deal, having her car stolen. It's not lost on me how that impacted her. And it's and then we're on this weird side. And then there is a dispute in what was actually shown that night, and I'm glad Commander Parman was able to pull that up, but it was like a handwritten bill of sale or something. At least that's what the officer said, and we didn't have something that could establish something different than that in that moment. And so I think that's where it gets, you know, and the chief making his final call, he has to look at exactly what's in the record at that time. And
That's really helpful to me. I think this is a really tough one. I can understand. I wasn't at the original hearing, but in reviewing the recordings of the conversation that took place, I can understand why it was so divided.
So I'd like to jump in. Ms. Schiller and I provided the reasoning for the challenge memo. So, you know, much of the reasoning that I still hold to has already been covered. But I want to say, I understand the reasons that this case could seem difficult, you know, the policy reasons behind wanting a heightened standard before you do the sort of enhanced stop on a stolen vehicle, and even the dispute over exactly what the document was that was shown. And certainly, you know, there's a problem if what happens when you go to the DMV is not totally lined up or reflected in an accurate way with the wording of the directive. It seems like, you know, of course there's some reconciliation that has to be done there. You know, maybe your people can talk to the DMV's people, get that totally straightened out. But to me, what makes this simple, and really on what I based my decision before when this came up on appeal, is just the wording of the directive. Just, it seems very simple to me. Specifically in situations that do not meet the previous criteria, but, you know, presumably have some suggestion that there could be a plausible reason to take a report from someone. But, you know, one of these pieces of evidence precisely that's listed out is not present. The officer must contact a supervisor for authorization. What makes it feel so simple to me is I don't understand how a reasonable person reviewing the language of the directive alongside all of the evidence in this case could not decide that the officer had violated policy by failing to contact a supervisor for authorization. Because it seems like whether it was something like a handwritten bill of sale or whether it was the notice of transaction submitted that's in the record, to me it seems very clear that the appellant presenting either one of those things, you know, anything that might be described as a handwritten bill of sale or the actual notice of transaction submitted, should have triggered the officer to, like Ms. Schiller said, you know, take it up the chain in accordance with the directive. That's really what I'm getting hung up on.
Well, I was hung up on that too, but then I could get hung up on it again. But it seems like it says in order to take, in order to accept a report of a stolen vehicle, they must put it up the chain, but it doesn't say that they must put it up the chain to not accept the report or to not put through the report.
And to add to the confusion, apparently the vehicle, there was an attempt to register the vehicle, but the complainant didn't sign the registration form. and then the DMV didn't register it, try to contact her, it didn't go to the correct mailing address, and they ended up refunding the money for the registration, so it was never in their computer system. I'm not sure what, with all the time frames and the dates and so on, if it would have even made it in time for the police bureau to check and find it in there, but there was just a calamity all over the place here as to how this went down.
So let me jump in to say real quick that the appellant is in the audience and has raised their hand. I looked at the code. It doesn't say anything specifically about, whether we let appellants in conference hearings give a statement or comment. So I'm being informed by David that it's kind of open-ended and we can make that decision. So I wanted to get a feel from you all if you would like me to let the appellant speak or not.
I think yes, I would be in favor.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. Seems like we are all yes, or at least majority. So let me give the appellant a moment here to come speak to us. Hello.
Hello.
Not you, Vadim. Hi. I don't want to say your name out loud, but if you would like to speak. Hold on. Let me try something else.
No, I think she got the stuff figured out. I think she can talk now.
I'm giving her panelists instead. There we go. Okay, you can go ahead.
She still have it mute.
Still muted.
There we go. If you're speaking, we can't hear you, but it looks like you're unmuted.
Okay. Hi. Can you hear me now? Sorry about that. Okay. Do you want me to give my name, or I'm not sure how this process works?
That is totally up to you if you'd like to share your name for the record, but I will not do it on your behalf.
Okay, so my name is April Fletcher, and I'm the one who started this process for having my car not being reported stolen. I'm very thankful for you guys to even hear this and make some maybe hopefully some changes for the future on stolen cars. I wanted to let you guys know, though, I'm not sure when we went. I thought we were under the understanding that the piece of paper that I was given, the handwritten one that the officer referred to, was the paperwork that he did see. But I'm here.
You muted yourself by accident.
Hearing that you guys are not what he saw, is that correct? Did you hear what I
don't know. I kind of, it was a little choppy, so you might have to repeat what you asked. What's your question?
Okay, I'm sorry. I've never used this Zoom before, so I'm not really sure about it. I was under the impression that when we went through the conference before, that everybody was in agreement that the piece of paper that I had shown the officer was the notice of transaction. And document. So you go to the DMV and you submit your registration, you turn in the title along with the bill of sale. And also, you will fill out this piece of paper. Yellow paper is what you get back as the registration until you get the permanent one. So the only piece of paper I could have possibly given to the officer is the handwritten transaction, which is the beginning of the registration. because the DMV had the rest of it.
Thank you, April. I am hearing that your APA, TJ, would like to speak as well. Is that all right with everybody?
I would. Thank you.
Go ahead, TJ.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Great. First of all, there's some questions of facts that are not, that seem to be disputed, that are not disputable. The officer wrote in his, when he was questioned by internal affairs, all of you, when it said he was handed a handwritten note, a yellow handwritten note. This is a notice of transaction submitted. It is yellow, but it's stamped. There is a stamp from the DMV on here. So this is not a handwritten bill of sale, and it's not a piece of paper that somebody can just go in there and pick up. At the hearing, I submitted the letter from the Department of Transportation dated May 29th, 2019, where they are writing to her that she can't, because of the mess up, that she can't proceed with this. And it says at the bottom that they're returning the original form 226, the original form 515, and the original bill of sale. So the DMV had the bill of sale. There was no way that she could have given any officer a bill of sale because it has to be submitted to the DMV at the time. Like, that's in writing. We have proof of this. And she asked the officer to call the supervisor when she gave this, because this is all she had. It's very clear when I went to the DMV to find out, because I do understand the confusion, Chief. Because the only thing on this DMV, it says notice of transmission submitted. It doesn't say anything else. And I wasn't sure what it was. So I went to the DMV with this receipt to ask them what the purpose of this piece of paper was. And they had a really long line and got very annoyed with my questioning. So he said, just tell me what the problem is. Because I said, is this? Would you just tell me what the problem is? Somebody had their car stolen. They needed to hand the officer proof of ownership, and they did. Well, that's what we make those for. He got very angry at me. And so from the DMV's perspective, this is exactly what you're supposed to hand to a police officer. I didn't find his notes after the encounter to be particularly helpful or detail-oriented. His questioning, which of course he's coming off of memory, is that she handed him a handwritten bill of sale, which is just not possible because the DMV had it at that time. So I don't think this is such a problem with the facts of the case, of what was actually handed. I think that Andy, sorry to call you by your first name, I can't read the back. I think your questioning is exactly point on. This is what she was handed from the DMV. This is what she was told the purpose of. But Chief, let me just tell you the last thing I want to tell you, because I know, and it's nice to see you, Chief.
Thank you.
The upshot of all this, besides the woman losing her car, not getting, you know, the impound fees, everything that happened, they actually caught the car thief, Chief, in Merriam County. And you know how hard it is to find a car thief. They could not prosecute him because there was no stolen vehicle report on the car. So not only is this woman out money, public safety was not served, and Merriam County was not happy about that. So, you know, maybe error on the side of the complainant isn't just taking care of her needs at the moment, it also serves public safety. And thank you. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you both for that information. Where are you right now, Chief Lavelle? I mean, obviously this process is for you and us to come to an agreement. So given all this information, where are you?
Yeah, you know, that's valuable additional information. I think it's worthwhile on my end to maybe have a conversation with DMV to see what the real feeling is behind that piece of paperwork, even though it says this notice is not an indication of temporary registration or proof of registration, but maybe it's something that, you know, DMV says, hey, this is all this person's going to get. This is what they give us in exchange, kind of what TA was alluding to. And then maybe there's the potential in our directives to add that as a potential additional item to show proof. But I think it would require a little bit of research on our end to be comfortable with it. But, you know, I can see in this case, you know, someone was left in a position where, you know, they did have a loss because of this lack of clarity. So, I mean, that's something I'm willing to explore on our end with the police bureau and DMV.
Thank you. Dana, we ended up going into like talking and then we kind of got away from the fact that we do have a spot for IPR to give their thoughts. So did you want to do that real quick, Dana?
Sure. I just have one kind of quick thought. And since the chief has already done his thing, one of the things, and you guys hear me say this all the time, this would be the perfect kind of case for a policy review. And I think, you know, one, to make recommendations around the directives around taking stolen car reports. This is a perfect case for, you know, CRC to undertake. And this is, again, as I've said many times, this is where your power lies in terms of making policy recommendations for the city. And could even go into, it sounds like there's also some issues with DMV, which lies outside of all of our purview. And I think that that's one of the huge problems and why this case has been so sticky. But, you know, with regard to how the police interact with, you know, DMV documentation and everything, I would just say I would lay at your feet a recommendation that you undertake a policy review with regard to these directives that are involved in this case.
Thank you. Okay, so what I'm hearing from you, Chief Lavelle, also, obviously you're talking about a future case and wanting to prevent a future case by updating the policy, but we need to address what was the policy and what, based on the evidence, we feel was the right action for the officer to take. People have given their different opinions, and at first it seemed like we were still on, you know, two sides of it. So are you coming closer into sustained, or where are you on the actual finding?
You know, this is a tough one. Now, do I have to make a decision on this right now, would be my question.
I would ask IPR that. I don't know that it says there's a timeline in the code.
Yeah, code is silent on this part. The conference hearing is for you guys to talk with the chiefs and resolve your disagreement. So
I think the biggest thing is if you were not to make a decision here and now, we might need to bring you back in to have a discussion about what your decision is, just to keep the transparency and also to assure that we get an answer. If you don't feel comfortable making the decision right now, I would personally recommend we would bring you back, but what do other people think?
Well, Candace, I mean, I think people aren't gonna change their mind with respect to how this vote goes, so we can vote on what we see, whether we agree with the new finding or whether we agree with our initial finding. And then, you know, if Chief Lavelle agrees with whatever our vote is, then, you know, that's that at any point in time prior to going to City Council, I suppose. And if he disagrees, then it goes to City Council. So we don't, in my view, we don't really have to wait for Chief Lavelle. It's just a question of whether he wants to elevate it or go with the vote if the vote is not in the PPB's favor.
I mean, I kind of understand that, but I also feel like the vote that we're supposed to take is on a decision that we make. And if the chief isn't going to make a decision right now, then I don't know what vote we take. Like, is it, this isn't a re-betting of the hearing. It's not like we're making another vote on the hearing. This process, at least from what I'm understanding it, is we have a decision, and let's say the chief says, yes, I want to move it to this, or no, I don't. And then we say, okay, well, we agree with you or we don't agree with you. So I don't know what the vote would be exactly if it's not including whatever the chief's decision is.
Well, I guess it's that
people Vadim. I'm going to say that we can take a vote on what his original proposition was. And his original proposition was changing the finding to not sustained with the debrief. And if enough people agree with that original proposal, then that there doesn't have to be additional work on the chief's part, and that is the end of it. If we, enough of us, still believe that it should be sustained, then the chief could take more time, think about that vote, and then come back again. So the vote would really, I think, be key to his original suggestion.
Well, but my understanding was that the chief wasn't sure if he agreed with his original suggestion and was wanting more information, which I think I would want to defer to the desire to get more information.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Dana. So for the sake of the process, if we went with the decision of not sustained with the debrief, CRC could vote. But in the meantime, between the time it would go to council, I could have said conversations with DMV and make, a change to my sustained with the debrief at a time prior to it going to council.
I can confirm that this have happened in the past with CRC meetings. Yes, you can do that, Chief.
So essentially what you're saying is that we would vote on whether we agree that it should be sustained with a not sustained with the debrief, right? That's your recommendation. But if we don't agree, then we're gonna start the process of going to city council, but we'll just wait to hear back and maybe it'll get resolved before it goes to city council, is that?
Yes, yes, okay. This have happened in the past, and we received a memo from the chief agreeing with the committee on the on the finding of sustain, mm-hmm. and that case was closed.
Okay. So in that case, then I think a next appropriate step is that somebody would make a motion and we would have a second, and we could maybe discuss it a little bit and then open it up for public comment for them to discuss, and then we come back and make a final vote. Is that how I'm interpreting the next steps, David?
Yep. That sounds good.
Okay. So is that the route we want to go? Does somebody want to make a motion?
Wait, I just want to put out there that I think this is a really tough case, and that there's a lot of people on, the previous vote was very close. I think this vote could be very close, and that understanding what the chief feels about this is really important to me. That's the purpose of this hearing, is to understand the chief's point of view and to take a vote without feeling like the chief's point of view is set in stone feels uncomfortable to me.
I agree with you, Julie.
Yeah, I'll give you the sense of where I'm at. I feel like, someone suffered a loss because of the lack of clarity or, the connection between the DMV's process and the PPB directive, right? So I don't want that to happen to someone in the future. And I don't want another officer to be placed in a precarious situation where he or a sergeant or detective have to make this tough call if we can clarify it through our directive process and communication with DMV. So I feel like there's a fix here, but it's going to take a little bit of conversation and time. But that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Sylvan, I saw you unmute if you want to go, and then I'll have a thought.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. My thought was just procedural. It looks like in your facilitation outline that public comment would occur before the motion and vote. So that's all I was going to say if we were headed towards a motion and vote.
Yeah, I put it in there not really knowing exactly where.
Oh, okay.
So that's on me. Yeah, I put it, I was like, I'm not sure how that plays out. So that's why I wanted to confirm with David. So it looks like we can make a motion, talk about it a little bit more. That way the people have something to comment on whether they think that we should vote for it or against it. Jihan, go ahead, and then I'll add one thought.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask a question of Chief Lavelle. The letter from the chief is dated January 6th, and it says at the bottom that the chief is directing the policy group in partnership with Records Division to discuss with the DMV to ensure our policy is still aligned with DMV practices. I'm wondering if that has happened, because it sounds like this is what you want to do in the future, and I don't know if that has happened in the past 7 months that since the letter was written.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that process has been completed or what the outcome was, but that's something I would like to look into and research. I mean, when these come for us, it's like, oh, you know, it kind of highlights a gap, and you think, well, this could happen to other people. So to me, it is really a policy DMV kind of issue. That's where the fix is in this situation. So I want to explore that more.
I guess what I'm sitting with here is I totally understand the desire to want to fix the root, which seems to be the directive being unclear. But our responsibility is to look at the case and make a decision based on what the directives are. So while I get where you're coming from, what concerns me and what I'm trying to grapple with is the fact that based on the evidence, it sounds like we're all in agreement that, you know, some kind of thing was not upheld or like it, and it's a performance issue, right? Like in the way that we structured the misconduct, sorry, I don't know if I'm making sense, but it's underperformance. It's pretty minor. But I think that, I guess I'm just kind of like feeling, so is that always the case? Like instead of saying per the directive, you did not comply with it and therefore there is a consequence to it, instead of, and we're going to try to fix something. And I get that, you know, these are real people and, you know, it's that this is a stressful situation for them and all of that. I totally get that. And I don't want to be in a place where we're always just, well, the directive was wrong, not the person's interpretation of the directive. And therefore we're just going to fix the directive, but we're not going to have any consequences for the person that caused harm to a community member as a result of how they interpreted the directive. And we agree that they interpreted it incorrectly. Does that make sense? So I'm just trying to figure out where that fits into all of this, especially since you're saying you want to, you know, take some time to think about it some more. But I'm trying to get, I'm looking out at the bigger picture, and how do you feel about what I'm saying, and does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, it makes sense. My thought is that you would vote on it, and you see where, you know, where we land on it. And then in the meantime, for, you know, for the police bureau and DMV to have a conversation or figure out what can be accepted policy-wise for proof of insurance or proof of ownership, we can have that, you know, discussion afterwards.
And Cliff, did you want to add something?
No.
I just saw you were unmuted, so I didn't know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's Commander Portman again. I wanted to go back, and I appreciate the input from the appellant and from her advocate. And, you know, I went back and I reread the officer's interview, and I appreciate the assertion that there is certainty that the officer was handed that notice of transaction. But in the officer's interview, he's asked again, you know, what he was provided. He said it was like a handwritten bill of sale. She said something about not being able to afford paperwork. So we said, get the paperwork, call us back. Happy to take a stolen car report. And then in the officer's transcript a little later on, he's asked about whether or not he's familiar with paperwork from the DMV. And he replies, yes, I'm familiar with it because I used to sell cars before I was a cop. And so he knows what the DMV forms look like. And he asserts in his interview that he did not receive the DMV form.
The DMV forms for retail car sales are different than what a private sale is. This would be. So I don't know if I buy like him being familiar with a dealer form. I don't know necessarily indicates that he was aware that he could look for other documents.
He also goes on to say further down, if you keep going, that he was not sure what documents would be required for a private sale.
Actually, he provided an answer and said they would need proof of registration, some kind of secure odometer. There's like 3 or 4 pieces of paper required in a private sale to send to DMV. So I just, again, I raise this not because, you know, I think, you know, when we look at findings, you know, we are bound to preponderance of the evidence. And it seems like a very critical fact in this case is it's difficult to get to a preponderance of evidence to be certain that that notice of transaction is what was shown to the police officer in this case. And I think even if we get to that point, that there's evidence in the record that that document in and of itself doesn't clearly establish ownership. And I hear and feel the frustration, and I am as frustrated. I mean, nobody wants our policies to unintentionally harm people or to prevent us from doing our job. But I think this is an area where it's difficult, based on my reading the case file, it's difficult to get to a preponderance of evidence about what specifically that officer was shown. Because there are differing opinions.
So are we gonna vote as to whether we're gonna vote? is that where we are?
Well, yeah, the last thing was if somebody wanted to make a motion to do a vote. So is somebody there?
Candace, I still had a couple questions, and I don't know if we're too deep into this process of deciding what next moves we're going to make, but I still have a couple clarifying questions about
the case.
So, and I know this has been asked a couple times, and I apologize if it's me misunderstanding, but I would really, really appreciate clarity under 630.61, 1.3.1.2, as the complainant provides documents from the DMV indicating process of transfer of title. And I'm wondering if an officer were to take a stolen vehicle report based on proof of ownership fitting that category, what that document is, or documents.
Can you say the number again just so I can follow?
1.3.1.3.1.2. Hopefully I didn't pull up an old version of the directives, but.
Are you looking at the directives like on a website or are you looking at the case file?
I think on the website, so perhaps it's.
You should follow the directive in the case file. Okay. Because directive change quite often and the directive in the case file is the one that apply to that case at the time. So it's in tab 3.
Okay.
Yeah, didn't mean to derail you. I just was trying to follow along, so I wasn't sure where you were pointing to. Can you just go ahead.
It's the same. Clayton provides documents from the DMV indicating process of transfer of title. Language is different from what I copy and pasted.
Okay, that looks good. Go ahead and finish asking. And who is that to? Is that to the chief or?
I guess to Chief Lavelle or any of the other fellows at PBB. I'm just curious what document or documents fit that box.
I thought Cliff was going to say something there.
Yeah, but he's muted.
No, I was going to say, you look like you were going to say something. I didn't know if you were going going to jump in. I'm having worked the street for 17 years and taken a number of these, I can say that this is an unusual situation in that you have a car kind of in the midst of transfer and it gets stolen and there's that to deal with. I mean, typically it's you have a signed title or something that shows proof of ownership. But I think kind of getting back to the central issue, and like Brian, Commander Parman said, I kind of feel the tension around this issue too. I think I keep going back to what was actually provided to him and what we do or don't know. And I think that to me is the central issue, is we really can't get to what was provided to him that night. I mean, I do think there's some relevance in being in the car business and knowing what those forms look like. I do think there's some relevance to saying that it was a handwritten piece of paper. And I do think that, we have to balance all of these competing interests in making a decision on whether or not to enter a report into LEDS and allow things to unfold and unfold. And so I would say that certainly there's enough information in there that we would want to see maybe a further look at it. It sounds like there was a conversation between the appellant and the officer stating that she was going to try and get that additional information and get it back to the officer. And at the same time, we have a responsibility if we have enough information to take it to that next step and see what we can do with that and make that call at just a little bit higher level. So I wish I could sit here and say the thing that everybody wants to hear. I just, at the end of the day, what's in dispute is what was actually shown to that officer that night. And that really is the central issue of what we're talking about. And using the preponderance of the evidence standard, it's very hard to get to exactly what was shown. And is that enough evidence to tip the scales one way or another?
So hypothetically, what would that document be?
I'm not going to speak to hypothetically what it would be. I'm just talking about what was or wasn't shown that night and what the officer could establish from what he had that night. And what he said he had was a handwritten bill of sale.
Can I ask a follow-up on that? Because I know we keep getting caught up in that, like, the bill of sale, and then what's the other one called? The notice of transaction submitted. But also for clarification, and if I missed it, I'm sorry. Is it that this list, we've decided that this list is, it needs to be one or more of this list. And even if it was bill of sale, even if it was notice of transaction, both of those are on the list, or am I reading that wrong? Is that the argument from, Andy or others that are feeling like there's both are on the list, so no matter what paper the officer was given, it should have triggered that next step? Am I reading that right?
Well, the bill of sale, I don't think there's a question. The bill of sale wasn't notarized. So the directive requires a notarized bill of sale. So I think.
How are you establishing that?
I'm looking at the directive and it says.
No. Oh, I thought you were speaking to what was shown that night or not.
No. Oh, okay. I don't think there was a notarized. I don't think there's any evidence on the record that there was a notarized bill of sale.
Okay. I misunderstood. I apologize. Yeah.
The directive requires, if it is a bill of sale, the directive requires it to be notarized. And I don't think there's any evidence of that.
Yeah, thank you.
That documentation exists.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me. So then that puts it into question that if it was the unnotarized bill of sale, then it wouldn't have met this standard. But if it was the notice of transaction submitted, it would have met it, right?
And I have proof.
And I think there was proof at the hearing, and also again, the appellant's APA said that the bill of sale is required to be submitted to the DMV in order to start this process. So in this situation, the appellant could not have had in her possession the notice of transaction submitted and the bill of sale. So if we're talking about a question of what documentation the appellant had and presented to the officer, there was sufficient proof that the appellant submitted that documentation to the DMV. She did not have a bill of sale because that documentation was submitted to the DMV in order to get the receipt, the notice of transaction submitted. So she could not have submitted, she could not have shown the officer a handwritten bill of sale because she didn't possess it at the time.
Thank you for clarifying that. And I see that the appellant has their hand raised. Are we okay with them speaking? Yes, okay, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I wanted to let you know that at the hearing we did bring documentation from the tow yard when they put a lien on me, and I asked the tow yard how they were able to put a lien on me if they said it was showing in the computer that the other lady was still the owner. They said because you had financial interest in it, meaning the owner, original owner, had released interest and it released it to me. That's why the lien from the tow yard had been put on there under my name. So that being said, how could the tow yard see that she had released the interest to me, but the officer couldn't see it?
Again, I don't have the case file in front of me. My understanding was that when the vehicle was towed, the tow yard called the existing registered owner. Is that correct? Because it wasn't registered in your name. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
The tow yard did, and so at that point, when they did not reach her, then they looked deeper and found that she had released the interest to me, and that's why they put the lien on me. And I asked the tow yard, should you not have contacted me within 48 hours? Because I had financial interest at that point. That's why they did the opposite of that, if the tow yard could.
Is it April? Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
How long between the time that you took ownership of the car and it was stolen? What was the length of time in there? Like I said, I apologize. I don't have the file.
I think it was just a couple weeks, maybe.
Couple weeks.
Maybe a week and a half, too.
Okay. Gotcha.
I could look at the game, but.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
So where are we? Taylor, did you have more questions?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, and I guess in 1.3.1, which is, let me go back to the tab 3 in the directive, make sure my, because I have like a whole bunch of notes I like copied and pasted into a document, but let's make sure it's the same. It says, in order to accept a report on a stolen car, members shall conduct a preliminary investigation. And as part of that investigation, ownership must be established. And that's how we get to the non-exclusive list, right, of all the different documents. And that's where maybe this notice of transaction, like I can see the ambiguity. I really wish I would get an answer on the complaint, like what a documents indicating a process of transfer of title could mean. But it seems like that's a non-exclusive list. And there, even if she had presented a bill of sale, which I know TJ Browning is indicating that that would be impossible for the process, there was several indications that there needed to be more investigation and that ownership could be established. And it just strikes me that, I mean, maybe it is, I think as Cliff suggested, maybe the passage of time between that and when the car was, or the lien was placed on the car, maybe there was enough time for some ownership to be established. But it seems like the towing company did more investigation into this than the police officer. And that's where I wonder if, that's where 1.3.18 comes in, is that there was several indications in that non-exclusive list that maybe don't necessarily resolve towards ownership, or maybe that they're ambiguous, but it seems like a situation, just reading on it, and I would like the chief's input of just where there is ambiguity, it would seem it'd be like the opposite of, I guess, the rule of lenity. I think of this in criminal law, which is like, if there's ambiguity in a statute, you resolve that for the defendant because somebody's liberty is at risk. But this is professional standards. And I wonder if there's ambiguity, and I think Candace mentioned this earlier, why wouldn't it be, it seems like the 1.3.1.8 resolves the ambiguity towards contacting a supervisor. I'm curious what Chief Lavelle's thoughts are on that last, on the 1.3.1.8 is, and like what that role of that specific subsection is.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where the debrief part might come in, at about additional follow-up. To me, there was an opportunity, you know, where the officer could have taken, you know, an additional step. Even when the person said they'd call back with additional paperwork, there could have potentially been some follow-up there. Even contacting potentially the listed owner to see if they had sold that vehicle to someone else. I think that's where the potential for the debrief comes in. But I think in this situation, it's really hard to say the officer, you know, is sustained for violating a policy when there's so much ambiguity, and what he's saying he received would not have met the, what is, like Cliff said, a high bar of proof of ownership for, you know, for very good reasons as far as how stolen vehicles are stopped and approached.
I would just like to point out, we're spending some time talking about what a high bar it is. One of the things that's listed as something that would be satisfactory would be a telephone report if the complainant can describe the vehicle type and make and names of other registered owners. That, you know, and unique features including bumper stickers. I feel like if you could prove ownership by describing bumper stickers, among other things, that something, like Taylor was saying, I feel like even if it was a handwritten bill of sale that was shown on the night in question, I agree. I feel like it should have clearly triggered 1.3.1.8. And I appreciate the instinct to go, you know, toward a debrief with that, but I'm curious how it doesn't seem like a violation of the directive.
I think I was originally thinking that this was, that violated subsection H, and I think we're talking about the same subject. I'm looking at the version of the directive that was in the case file, so the numbering is a little different, but the subsection that requires contacting a detective or a sergeant for authorization. Originally, in my reading of that, I thought that in situations that didn't fall under A through G, the officer had to contact a detective or sergeant, had to put it up and escalate it. But I think Ms. Falk brought up a good point where it could be read differently, where if in the absence of A through G, the officer still wants to take a report, that officer must escalate it and get approval from a detective or a sergeant. So does anybody on the PPB, do you want to weigh in on the interpretation? Because I think it's vague as written. And my original reading is that they, if something was presented that didn't fall within A through G, they had to escalate it. But another reading is, if they still want to take a report and it doesn't fall through A through G, in A through G, then they have to contact a detective or a sergeant. Does someone on the PPB want to weigh in on their interpretation of that directive?
And before they weigh in, Taylor, since you have it open on the website, can you copy paste it into the chat so that they can read it directly? Thank you.
One second. I had it open and then I backed out to double check where I was.
I can also read it. H, subsection H says, in situations that do not meet the previous criteria, officers must contact a detective or sergeant for authorization to accept a report of a stolen vehicle. If unable to contact a detective or sergeant, i.e. it's after hours, officers must obtain approval of a supervisory sergeant. The person authorizing the report shall be documented in the report.
This is Brian Parma. Can you all hear me?
Yep.
Okay, sorry, I had to switch to my phone. My internet connection is lagging. So I think to answer the question, I think in practice, the way this has been applied is if somebody had some other unique way to prove ownership, the example that comes to mind is, say, you know, my father had recently passed away and he's the registered owner of the vehicle and it was stolen and I have my father's death certificate, some other weird document, not only weird, but another document that would show that the car is stolen and I can report it on someone else's behalf. Maybe that's not the most artful example, but in a unique situation like that, if the officer believes that the complainant has established ownership using something that is not listed, they have to run that by a supervisor. It has not been, but I believe, you know, now reading it, there certainly is ambiguity, but I don't think it's ever been viewed as, if you show up and if you don't believe they've provided ownership, you are required to run that by a supervisor. It would be a case where somebody, you believe they've replied, they've established ownership and the ability to report using some other document that isn't listed there.
I mean, if that's the interpretation, I certainly think that the officer presented with a document from the DMV indicating some sort of beginning of a process should have, if there was any question about whether or not it was valid, should have escalated still. But I think that would be hard for us to say that he violated subsection F. I still believe he violated subsection B, but I think it would be hard for us to say that he, in that situation, should have escalated it, because I think it gives the officer discretion. I think my opinion is, presented with a document from the DMV from someone claiming their car was stolen, he should have, one, conducted more investigation, has been acknowledged here, but absent that, should have, pursuant to H, contacted some a detective or a sergeant. But I think I would have a hard time saying he violated subsection F if that's the interpretation of the rule.
Yeah, and I think that gets us back then to the policy review and the obvious, you know, that we can do a better job providing clarity to our members as it relates to this important point.
Chief Lavelle, did you have any thoughts on that?
No, not different than I had already stated. I think for me going forward, I want to give more clarity, you know, to officers, and also to prevent this from happening, to the next person who finds themselves in this weird window. And I think, following up with DMV and just really looking at our policies can provide a fix to this going forward. But I still, you know, agree with Candace as far as the need to, you know, come to a resolution on this too.
And I think I'll just say one more time that my feeling is, it's one thing to create a future decision or impact a future decision by changing policy, but I feel I get why it's difficult to maybe discipline someone because it's unclear, but I feel like there are lots of situations where a directive can be unclear to, what am I trying to say? I guess your reasoning for why you don't right now feel that it should go sustained is because you are unclear on it, and it seems like there's unclarity on the, is that a word? On the directive. I'm still grappling with the fact that there's still an appellant who was harmed by this, and do we just say, well, we'll do better next time, they're not going to receive any consequences, even if it's minor. I don't know that this consequence is going to be super major, but maybe I'm not understanding the conduct matrix or discipline matrix well enough. I don't know. I just think there's validity there to saying this was wrong. and therefore there's a consequence when you do something wrong and harm a community member. And we're going to fix it in the future, but you need to be held accountable for this. So I'm still stuck with that. I don't know where anyone else is, but I definitely think we should start moving in the direction of making a motion so we can get to a resolution. Andy, go ahead.
I was going to ask if I can make a motion.
Yes.
I move that we maintain our prior recommendation of sustained for the violation of this directive.
Okay, there's a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Sylvan seconds. So we want to have, why don't you speak on your motion, Andy?
Do we take public comment or do we vote?
We won't take public comment until we're done talking about it real quick, and then we'll, okay. Yeah.
I maintain my earlier position that the finding should be sustained. I believe that there is a preponderance of evidence that what was presented to the officer was the notice of transaction submitted, which is a filled out form from the DMV that was stamped as received from the DMV. I believe that the appellant's testimony that she could not have provided a bill of sale because that bill of sale had already been transmitted to the DMV as part of the title transfer process was credible. And I believe that the document that she had falls under the broad language of subsection B, which is a document from the DMV indicating the process of transfer of title. And because that doc, I believe there's enough evidence showing that she presented that document, and I believe that document is falls under that subsection B, that I believe that he violated the directive, so I believe that it should still be sustained.
Thank you. And Sylvan, you want to speak on your second?
I mean, for the sake of time, I could just associate my comments with Ms. Schiller's. I found the testimony from appellant and her advocate at the appeal hearing to be convincing in terms of which documents would or would not have been even in her possession to show, and I also agree that the language on documents from DMV indicating process of transfer of title, I feel like it must encompass the notice of transaction submitted. So I will stick with our sustained finding from the appeal hearing.
Great, so any other discussion before we move into public comment, and then we'll move into a vote from there. Nadine.
Yeah, I've been having a hard time grappling with it even during the original vote as well. You know, we have circumstances where we have a police officer who worked in a dealership that should know the difference between a transfer of, should know the difference between a bill of sale, handwritten or otherwise, versus the notice document. Certainly would know what a bill of sale would look like. We also have a policy here that we're having a hard time understanding what it means. And so the first step is, could a reasonable person believe that the police officer saw only a bill of sale and that was not sufficient to take this report because it was not notarized? And the second step would be, was the policy clear enough about what documents were acceptable such that what was given would have triggered one of the other ones? And it seems we're having a hard time understanding what the policy says. So with respect to that second part, I think it's difficult to say that, let me formulate in my mind. I think it's difficult for me to say it as well, but I think it's difficult to say that a person could not find reasonably that an individual did not follow that policy, since we're not quite sure what that policy actually entails. The first part in my mind is still what I'm trying to grapple with. You know, we have the complainant saying that she presented this notice. The notice, as far as I can tell, should be good enough because I think it's the only thing that the DMV gives. My research online seems to indicate that is the only document that you get pending whatever comes in the mail later on. It does seem to be stamped. So once again, what I'm wrestling with is the he said, she said,
and what the finder of fact, how much latitude they should be accorded with believing the officer's testimony with that he did not see that document specifically, but saw a bill of sale versus what we're being told now that the notice document was provided. So just wanted to put that open there. I'm not really sure where I'm going to go with that, but that's I think that first part is more important to me than the actual policy.
Wait, are we taking a vote?
We're having discussion right now because then we'll go into public comment. After public comment, we go right into the vote. So that's why we need to discuss it now. Other discussion? Are you speaking, Taylor? I thought you were, but.
Sorry, I'm actually reading and I think I'm mouthing what I'm reading.
Oh, no worries. Okay, any other comments or deliberation?
Can I raise my hand?
Are you trying to speak?
Am I allowed to speak now? This is
sure. Are you wanting to speak in the public comment?
I don't know this process, so I don't know if the APA can speak or not. I have a timeline, and one of you asked about the timeline, and I have it, so I don't know if that would be pertinent for your discussion or not. I was trying to raise my hand, but I couldn't figure out how to do it.
Okay, yeah, I think I'm all right with that. Is everybody okay with that? All right.
All right, the car was purchased on July 15th. They went to both the seller because she did not have the title. The seller and the purchaser went to the DMV on July 24th, in which to get the submission piece of paper, she had to turn in the title, the handwritten title. The car, she called the non-emergency number on August 5th. Does that help you clarify anything? They bought the car July 15th, went to DMV July 24th, turned in all the paperwork, got the receipt that was stamped by DMV, and she called non-emergency on August 5th. So it was a pretty short timeline.
And where was the car? I don't know that I saw that anywhere. Like, where was
it? It was in the parking lot of her apartment building.
Okay. So she already had it in her possession, yeah. Right? Okay. Yeah.
And the mess up with the DMV is that the seller filled out, instead of a transfer of title, in case this is important or not, instead she filled out an application for a new title because she didn't have the title. So that's where the whole mess up came down, is that the complainant did the right paperwork, the seller did not. And so instead of a transfer, the seller asked for a new title because she didn't have it. And that's where the kerfuffle from the complainant happened. Fair enough? Is that clear, crystal clear? Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, TJ. Mr. Hanneman, I see you have a hand raised. I'm going to allow you to talk if it's a point of order. And if you're just waiting for a public comment, I'll put you back.
Okay. Are you able to hear me now?
Are you giving a point of order, or are you giving public comment?
I'm giving public comment.
Well, then I will wait until we're done discussing, and then we'll call you back, okay?
Oh, okay.
Okay. I think my thoughts... this is a tough case, and I totally understand everyone's perspective, honestly, which makes it really hard to make a decision, because I really do see where everyone's coming from. I feel I'm right now leaning towards sustain because I do believe that a reasonable person could have looked at the case and the evidence and decide that it needed to rise up. And also, what is the language? I have it pulled up here. Process of the transfer of title, section B. I don't know, the numbering's all off. I don't know what numbers you all are saying, but it doesn't look like that here, so I'm having trouble keeping up what numbers you're mentioning. But I'm seeing B B over here under 630.61. So yeah, I'm going to need to think about it for the next 5 minutes, but I'm definitely stuck. So any other discussion, Julie?
Sorry, these new headphones on, so I hope you can hear me. I think that I've said this several times. I think this is a really difficult decision to make here, but the language of the directive states that any of those documents may serve as documentation, which would put a process for which the officer could take a stolen vehicle report. It doesn't say that it must. And apparently a conversation took place in which he was expecting to have more information forthcoming. And I know that there's a salient point about what was given that night, but actually, even if it was what the appellant said, it doesn't seem like the officer was required to take it at that point. And then further, I think that language about putting it up the chain says, in order to to accept a stolen vehicle report, they have to get permission. Not they must get permission if there's ambiguity. So I would love to be able to vote to sustain this, but given our reasonable person standard, I will have to defer to the recommendation of not sustaining with a debrief. So that's a preview for my vote. I know we're not taking a vote yet, but that's my reasoning behind it.
Okay, other comments before we go into public comment? And a reminder that when you do your vote, you also have to give an explanation too. And you can say, I'm voting in this way because of the explanation the person before me just gave. That's okay, but just make sure that you're noting why. Last call for discussion. All right. So we're going to move into public comment before we go into the vote. For people in the audience, if you would like to give comment, please raise your hand. Use the raise hand feature. David, can you open up the chat in case people need to do it that way? And I don't know how to turn the chat on and off.
I just turned it on. We're good.
Where do you do that? Is that something I can also do?
Yeah, it's a little three dot. Right at next to the message box, click on the three dot and you can see the attendees can chat with a bunch of, like, the panelists, no one.
Yeah, I actually don't have that three dot. That's what I thought. Why I thought it was
weird.
Maybe it's just because I'm not the actual owner of Blaine, so we can
flesh
that out.
Yeah.
Cool. And then the chat is not open, so if you can't raise your hand for whatever reason, just let us know in the chat as well, and we'll get you up there. So first up, we have Mr. Handelman, and there you go.
Hi, this is Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch. And last time when you had this hearing back in December, I made a comment that we cannot afford to have our police be so cynical that they don't believe the people who are calling them. You know, this is a different kind of misconduct than what we're used to. It's not where a police officer actively hurt somebody. It's where they failed to take action, and then that person ended up getting hurt, as you all have mentioned, because of that failure to act. And I think that the issue with this part of the directive you're wrestling with is that if the officer wants to file the stolen car report, they have to go up the chain of command. This officer did not want to file the stolen car report. That's pretty clear. So that they did not believe the person, they didn't think they had the right paperwork. It's not clear to me how they saw the paperwork, because the paperwork that you gave us, the summary, case summary, only describes a phone call. So I don't know how they looked at anything, but if they did have a physical contact, well, I'm not sure why they wouldn't take a picture or make a photocopy of whatever it was so that you could show, you know, other detectives or other officers what proof the person did have. This is another failure by this officer. As kind of was hinted at by the APA, the incident happened The call happened August 2018. The complaint wasn't made until May of 2019, which was plenty of time for all the stuff with the DMV to have played out and for the internal affairs investigators to have sussed out all the information that you've been talking about whether or not the bill of sale was still in the person's possession and what piece of paper might have been given. So it seems like it was a very inadequate investigation in the first place. So however you come down on it, at the very least, this officer needs to be talked to about their attitude. You know, it doesn't matter whether they worked in a used car lot or not. If their purpose is to serve the public who are filing complaints about a crime that's been committed, they should be more accommodating to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Handelman. Next, we have Ms. Iona.
Okay, now I think I'm unmuted. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay, good. I'm Debbie Iona, League of Women Voters of Portland. Back in 2008, there was an outside expert review of the IPR, and one of the recommendations in that report was to add some supplementary findings as options beyond what you're considering right now. And examples are policy failure, equipment failure, supervisory failure. So those, it would be, this to me is a great example of a situation where policy failure would be a finding that would apply to this particular case. I realize it's not an option for you right now. I just wanted to point out that that's something that, you know, besides the 2008 recommendations, we had stakeholder groups, you know, reiterate those, you know, that as something that the police bureau should consider. And so I just want to throw that out there for perhaps, is it Commander Parman to consider, since he's the head of professional standards. So it's, more of a policy related comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Next we have TJ Browning.
Thank you for the thoroughness of your questioning. Again, I want to reiterate, at the hearing, I handed out the letter from the DMV that clearly stated they had the title in their possession when the car was stolen. It clearly said that. My concern is the not calling the supervisor. I take copious notes when I'm going through this stuff, and I don't have the case file anymore. But I wrote in quotes, won't take a report because it's, and I end quote, not in her name, unquote. She said to him, in quotes, can't you talk to your supervisor, end quote. The response from the police officer was no. The car's not in your name, and he will tell you the same thing I am telling you. It seems to me that when a citizen asks, and if the language of the directive is ambiguous, as some of you have said, they don't have to, they can, whatever. If you have a citizen whose car is just taken and they're requesting that you ask a supervisor if you can take a report, that seems a very reasonable request. And I think that this should be sustained, because I don't think that he fulfilled his obligation to the public by not taking that report. And at the very least, when asked by the citizen, the victim of the car theft, to please ask your supervisor. There's nothing in those directives that I'm listening to that would have denied him the ability to do that. That was an extremely reasonable request, and that is not serving our public in a manner that they should be. Thank you so much. You guys have done a great job. And last but not least, in the old days, we used to get copies of their notes, you know, taking notes, and I'm kind of saying this for the chief to hear too. And you could tell some officers did great notes, lots of details, lots of, you know, facts, and you could read them and you knew, you had such a good sense of what happened. And then other officers would like put two words in their notebooks. And I think that this officer's note taking was somewhat lacking, but that's not, that was directed at the chief, not at you all. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate your time.
All right, thank you, TJ. Any other public comments? Now is the time to raise your hand or let us know in the chat. Okay, we have Heavenly Help. You are up.
Hello, thank you for your time and care trying to think about this from all angles. Can you hear me? It seems to me that my conscientious 10-year-old child, and when I was younger than that, could have had no difficulty at all just taking a report. I am a mandatory reporter of elder abuse, child abuse, and abuse to people with disabilities. I don't have to believe and know all the facts. I simply take the information and move it forward. It doesn't take much difficulty to do that. The police who were illegally videoing and photographing and collecting data on people have no problem if they were going to be consistent and just take a photograph of the document and have that in the record with a receipt. And I would fire any of my employees if it took them a week to make a phone call or an email. But to have all these months and months in which this officer, the supervisors, and the chiefs have not followed through, even knowing that this is for public review, even knowing that this is one more evidence that is inflaming the public against the police for having no legitimacy or credibility, and should be given no authority or the inconsistency. It's very simple. The guy was a cop, lied, didn't fill out the reports properly. The supervisors did not have proper forms in which you have to fill in all the blanks and do everything. There wasn't a follow-up. There wasn't a requirement to have the pictures. And even without any of that, it's very simple. It's sustained. The officer was wrong, and the supervisors are wrong, and the chiefs were wrong. And we know what kind of policies to put in its place. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And then we've got Yume.
Hello, thank you. So I just had two very short points, kind of echoing what Mr. Handelman noted. It seems like there are two issues that you guys are deliberating on. One is sort of a factual issue about what documentation was handed to the officer. And the second is, you know, the broader issue of, regardless of what that documentation is, does that meet the standards set forth in the guidelines? And obviously I wasn't at the last hearing, but it seems to me, I guess I'm surprised that at no point in this investigation does it seem like it was established with DMV when they received this, you know, application for new title or whatever, which would kind of lend some understanding as to what document would have been in the appellant's hand at the time of the report. So it's possible that that was already dealt with by internal affairs, and I'm just ignorant of that. But at no point in this conversation have I heard someone say, oh yeah, we talked to DMV. They said that they received this on July 1st or August 1st or whatever. As far as the broader issue of whether or not this is, you know, within the directives of the PBB, I think I work in the insurance industry, and we typically look at any form of documentation as being sufficient to sort of establish, you know, an ownership interest, right? We look at a receipt of, you know, title transfer. We also look at, you know, handwritten bills of sale. Now, granted, you know, in the insurance industry, we are not going to put someone in a position where they could be stopped at gunpoint, but it seems to me that, you know, that's, there's a lot of quibbling about one document versus another. And I think that's an area where you guys could have, you know, a better procedure in place. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Yume. All right, any other people? Last call.
Candace, I just have a question. Someone typed a comment into the chat. Does that become part of the record, or should someone read that on behalf of that person? I'm not sure.
Oh, and David, I just found the three dots. I don't know. Should we read it out loud? Is that what you're asking? Like, should we read it into the record?
Yeah, I'm not sure if someone types in a comment, whether it just becomes part of the record.
I save a copy of the chat log, so yes, whatever people type in the chat, I save, so.
Okay, then yeah. I would just ask the other panelists, make sure to check that out because someone made another comment and it's just another thing for us to consider.
Oh, and Mr. Hammond is also saying that it only went to panelists.
I can read it out if they want to
hear
it.
Yeah, go ahead and read it, Andy. And actually, let me pause you. Barbara has raised their hand, so why don't I just let them speak? Okay. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, my comment was, first of all, the officer in this situation, to me, I've sold a car privately, and it's very different than a commercial sale. And to me, there is a window where there is a question. But at that point, any document of some support should be at least accepted and then followed up. He could have also fought on the Monday or whatever day, I don't know, without looking, could have simply phoned in the former owner and found out if it had been sold and then stated, you know, that it was stolen or put in. So I think there needs to be a follow-up on this. That's not exactly what I wrote there, but that's a just.
Great. Thank you, Barbara. All right. I think I got everybody. You've got 3 seconds. All right. So we are going to go ahead and move into a vote. Is everyone cool with that? Are we all comfortable? Any last clarifying questions anyone needs to ask?
I do have one belated comment, if that's okay. Something that Ms. Falk said was sort of rolling around in my brain. So I looked at part of the directive that we haven't really discussed, and you know, the numbering is all, I think we are looking at conversions, but the version I'm looking at is in the case file. It's in the same tab as the appeal request. The number on that is, but you know, just putting together sort of different valences on auxiliary verbs like may and must, which I know can be sort of hard to interpret the scope of linguistically when we're looking at directives. Ms. Falk pointed out that, you know, in establishing proof of ownership, one or more of the following may establish proof of ownership. And I see that point, like the end point of that being that maybe it wouldn't be compulsory to take the stolen vehicle complaint, depending on what the document was that was provided, you know, whether it would classify or qualify as proof of ownership. But that got me thinking, you know, what if it had been something that we would think of as very, very clear. Say, what if it was, just the actual registration or title, something that's pretty black and white that that we wouldn't really think would be up for dispute, you know, whether it was satisfactory. Sorry, I'm not explaining this very well, but I guess my point is, if we follow the interpretation that whatever the document is that is being presented as proof of ownership, if we're saying it only may establish it to the point where then a complaint would have to be taken, I feel like that's not a good result if you present someone with, if you present an officer with the actual registration and they say, well, I think that doesn't establish proof of ownership. I feel like that wouldn't smell right. And so I looked further up in the directive. And under responding member responsibilities, it does say, upon sufficient proof of ownership and indications that the vehicle has been stolen, members shall complete a general offense report. Now, I know that shall is tagged to sufficient proof of ownership and indications that the vehicle has been stolen, but I just want to point out that it's not it's not optional verbs like may and might all the way down. There is eventually a point where it seems like the directive says that the officer does have to act. And so if the question is sufficient proof of ownership, we look at the list of things that could be provided document-wise. But it doesn't seem like there's a hierarchy in the list, and it's also a non-exhaustive list. So I'm thinking, just as a thought exercise, you know, if we're dealing with the notice of transaction submitted, or if we're dealing with an actual title or registration, it just seems like there wouldn't necessarily be a hierarchy among those pieces of paper under the policy. And that at some point, if it is policy-wise sufficient proof of ownership, then the report does have to be made. So I hope that that made sense to anyone. And that's all I wanted to point out.
That makes sense.
That makes sense. And I'll also say that the next part too, I've been reading the denial of report, and it doesn't feel like any of these were also met. You know, it's like there's a husband-wife complainant, there's a divorce, there's, you know, a commercial private sale vehicle for which partial payment has been made, and it seems we've established that full payment had been made. Like, so even looking at, we've spent a lot of time in that first section, but then even putting that against the next section that talks about the reasons why you definitely should have more, I guess, be more judicious in whether you pursue it, because it could create that dispute that the officers also were saying they want to prevent, right? They want to prevent, like, pulling their guns on a husband that was, you know, like, it was a wife and husband dispute or whatever, right? So I also, in looking at that, going along with what you're saying, Sylvan, makes me lean more towards sustain. So let's go ahead and move to a vote. So the way I'm going to do this is I made a table for myself in here so that I can just keep track of everything. So I have y'all in alphabetical order, and I'm just going to call you in that order, and then you will vote and make sure to give your reason. So we will start with Adam Green.
Thank you, Candace. Four truths in this case that as I read it and as we deliberated today. One is that this directive is an absolute mess. Two is that the DMV is usually a mess. Three is that there was a lot of harm done to April because of these truths. And I absolutely agree that there was an inadequate investigation. My vote is sustained.
Thank you, Adam. Andy, you're next.
Because I think that the preponderance of the evidence shows that the appellant showed the officer a document from the DMV that falls under what is arguably a broad category in the directive of documents that show the process of the transfer of title. I believe that he should have taken a police report, or at the very least escalated it or conducted follow-up investigation. And for that reason, I vote that we should maintain the sustained recommendation.
Thank you, Andy. I am next in the list here. I'm going to vote sustained. I'm going to totally cheat and say because of what Adam and Andy said, because I don't know how to say it any better than that, but I agree with those reasons, and so therefore I vote aye. Next up, we have Jihan.
I also vote to keep the CRC's finding of sustained. I think these were my reasons before as well, and the deliberations today have not convince me otherwise. I believe that clause B includes the piece of paper that was shown to the officer, and that is in the case file. I have not been given any other indication of what an alternative document would have been that would fall under that category, and so therefore I've got to believe that that is the documents that it was meant under clause B. Further, when the RU manager had reviewed the case, her finding was that she did not know what that document would have been, could not believe that the notice of sale, notice of transfer was stamped by the DMV because she had never been through that process. And to me, that was a completely unreasonable finding. So for those two reasons, I vote to retain and sustain.
Thank you, Juhan. Next, we have Julie.
I very much respect the reasonings of all the previous votes and very much concur that the that there was a lot of harm caused by this situation, and I very much hope that it's remedied in a variety of ways, both through discussion with officers as well as potential changes in policy. But I continue to maintain that not sustain with a debrief is a result that makes sense to me. Going to vote.
Thank you, Julie. Next, we have Sylvan.
I'm going to vote to keep our sustained finding just for all the reasons that we've already discussed.
All right, and then Taylor.
I'm going to vote sustained, and I'm going to say that because I found the testimony from the minutes from the appellant persuasive. I found the statements from the appellant today and the statements from TJ Browning today persuasive. I'm reminded of the CRC's limitations and ability to have officers testify or just talk to us here today. I think we could have benefited from being able to ask the officer questions as to what kind of documents he saw. And reviewing the transcript, I was confused as to what the officer was referring to in handwritten documents. And because we don't have clarity or people talk, that officer talking about what he saw or getting more information, I did not find his part of the transcript persuasive. So I was persuaded by Commander Parman's discussion of the, I think it's 1.3.1.8, and about the ability for an officer to maybe kind of go above and beyond in circumstances like a passing of a relative to be able to prove ownership of a vehicle. That makes sense. It seems like that provision is more of a trap or a ceiling that allows officers to kind of pass through if they need to. But I come back to, and the reason I'm voting sustained is I do believe that based on what I've seen, the appellant did provide documents from the DMV to the officer. And I believe those documents indicated a transfer title. And I think that I realize this, that the large part of this directive gives officers a lot of discretion and it's ambiguous. But the clear part to me is and 1.3.1.2, the complainant provides documents from the DMV indicating a process transfer title. And it sounds like that's what happened. So for those reasons, I'm voting to sustain the CRC's previous finding.
Thank you, Taylor. And lastly, Vadim.
So I think this could have been handled much better. I think that the police officer should have followed up or at least done a little bit more investigation if he chose not to accept what the document was that was given to him. I think definitely should err on the side of a person who claims their car was stolen versus a hypothetical person. I think this was mentioned before, hypothetical person that might have had their rights violated by someone claiming falsely that a car was stolen. Once again, I said this during the last hearing that if someone gave false testimony to the police, there's repercussions to that. So err on the side of the person that had their car stolen. But that still leaves us with the burden of proof here, which is could a reasonable person, based on what we have in the record here, find that the police officer complied with the policies? It's not the preponderance of the evidence standard that we're seeking, but it's the standard that we have. And so we have an officer that testified that he knows what the paperwork's supposed to look like. He saw a handwritten bill of sale and nothing more. And that did not lead him to take the stolen vehicle report. And could the person reviewing this, including the police chief here have found it reasonable that that was the case, and I think it's possible. I think that the policy here is written very broadly, and it, you know, certainly needs to be improved upon, and I was hoping that by now that would have been acted upon, and it's unfortunate that that hasn't happened either, but I do think that the policy needs to be rewritten in order to take into account the circumstances in this case, even how unique that they are. But based on our standard review, I have to say that the chief's recommendation seems logical. If they can have a debriefing to the police officer about the need to follow up perhaps, and also change in policy or sharpening of the policy language, I think that's appropriate as well.
Thank you, everyone. So with a vote of 6-0, this motion passes. Therefore, CRC maintains their finding of sustained. So in that case, again, Chief Lavelle, typically we would have, you know, I mean, I guess you would have had like your final decision. It sounds like you want to continue to think about it and make a final decision. So is that where we're going from here, where you are, we're going to go ahead and, yeah, two voted against. I got that right. Did I get that wrong?
You say 6-0.
6-0.
I said 6-0. Because it's yay, nays, and abstentions.
Oh, sorry. My bad.
No worries. So yeah, Chief Lavelle, what are your next steps then? Do you have a timeline maybe you could offer and when you're going to get back to us on a decision?
I don't have a timeline in mind right now, but I can come back or get back to you fairly soon. There's definitely some things I think could be improved in this case. I appreciate everyone's perspectives, and honestly, I don't think any of them are really off base. This is just kind of one of those situations that's really kind of ambiguous in some ways that are just not really helpful to either, you know, officers trying to figure this stuff out or, you know, community members trying to get some remedy for their stolen property. So I definitely want to do some follow-up, and I agree there needs to be some looking into what has been looked at policy-wise with DMV and what we could do on the policy front to maybe change this and make it more you know, more clear for everybody involved. But I appreciate the time invested, and I think I can probably get back to you within the next couple of weeks. I do want to actually look into the DMV piece a little bit.
Okay. And also, just for everyone to have the right expectations, getting a city council hearing will likely take a few months. Anyway, so, but let's go ahead and go that direction, David, of starting to get it on their calendar, because I'm sure they wouldn't mind that something just pops off their calendar. So let's go ahead and go forward with that. Does that sound good?
Yes.
Great. And then, yeah, Chief Lavelle, we will expect to hear back from you in a couple weeks. I'm assuming that will be via another memo, but I know I personally would like you to come back in person if you could, in virtual person, just so that we could kind of close the loop. I think it'd be good for us to have a final discussion if that's cool with you.
Okay. And, you know, while April's still here, I just want to let her know that, you know, it's never our goal to see, you know, community members harmed or just not be able to get the service that they need, you know, from the police. That I just want to apologize to her.
Thank you.
I would suggest if it's possible to set a timeline, just so that we can have a date in mind by which the chief's, you know, possibly revised decision will be in hand. I'm just thinking, you know, for the sake of the appellant as well as the officer involved, to sort of know when we could expect these things to be moving.
Yeah.
Lavelle, do you think it's reasonable to set a deadline that is several weeks out, just so we've got something on the calendar?
And can the deadline maybe just be between now and our next meeting? Because it's always 4 weeks away, and you said a few weeks. Is 4 weeks good?
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Okay. So the first Wednesday of September, whatever that date is. Okay. Thank you. I think we are good with the conference hearing. So thank you, Chief Lavelle, for being here. You're definitely welcome to stay, but do not have to. And we're going to move on with our agenda. Thanks again.
Thank you. I'm going to grab some dinner.
You do that. Okay. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Thank you, everyone.
All right. Have a good night. Okay. Let me just real quick. Okay. Great. Well, let's go ahead and move forward. Let me see what else. One thing I have here on my list of, are there any policy training or quality of investigation issues the CRC would like to pursue as a result of all of this? I mean, I feel like we've talked at length about that, but throwing it out there, if anyone wants to add any final comments.
I guess more of a question than a comment. I think we're all in agreement that it was that this is a poorly written directive, and hopefully the police bureau moves on amending it. But I'm wondering if on the CRC side, if we want to actually put any effort into trying to come up with recommendations, concrete recommendations. And if so, it would probably be within a work group, and I'm wondering which one would take that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a policy and outreach thing. Would you agree, Adam and Vadim?
Yeah. Gladly take a shot at that. Adam, do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think that there's some sort of city code or something like that about how to initiate that. David probably knows that off the top of his head, but where we initiate a review of a current policy, and then we'll go down that road. It might need to be a vote of the CRC. David, does that ring a bell at all? Well, let's put a tab on that. I think we should review it, and then if I find the language about needing a vote, then we'll.
Yeah, I think the policy and outreach subcommittee could just undertake that without the full, like, there doesn't have to be a formal vote on that. I think that could just be subcommittee work, and then you would bring that the outcome of that work to the full CRC to then decide whether to enact whatever work you all did in the subcommittee. Did I say that in a way that makes sense?
It does, and that would make it much easier. I just have this thing in the back of my head where I thought we needed one, but that would make it easier. So yeah, let's do it in the subcommittee next meeting, and then I think it should take too much time to redraft. I think two sections there are pretty important, and then bring it to the police bureau.
Okay, and then did you have a comment, Jihan?
No, I was just trying to make sure that somebody was going to take it. But thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we go ahead and move on then, everyone? All right. And thank you, April. I see that you're in the chat. Thanks for being here and for clarifying. And we know this is really difficult, especially when these processes take many, many months and your, life is in the balance as a result. So we appreciate you being a part of this process, even though we know it's difficult. Thank you. All right, so next up on the agenda, CRC retreat follow-up. So what we had talked about at the meeting, we were going over, our capacity, how we think that we can use our time most efficiently in order to do things like talk more about our the issues in the retreat or just other like organizational issues. And we talked also at length about what does all of this mean with the recent ballot measure passing. And so we agreed last week to add like a 15 minute block of time where we could try and see if that works after we have a long hearing. Definitely it arose that it's hard after you do a big hearing to go in and talk at length about other things, but we decided we might try to just give it a 15 minute block. So for those that weren't at that retreat, so you can have context of why we have this here. And I would love to, more than anything, just talk real quick about how we feel about how we're doing our work moving forward. Let's just take a couple minutes to discuss that because there are people here that weren't at the retreat, and make sure everyone's on the same page. Does that make sense what I'm asking? I don't know if I asked it in a right, in a question, no. What are the ways that we as a committee want to do work beyond our appeals? So how do we fit that in? Do we try to establish time after our appeals to do some more work? Do we make our work groups, you know, maybe longer so that we have more of an ability to work through some issues? Do we just have higher expectations of outside work that people are doing and bringing into the work groups? Like, what does that capacity look like for people?
I think a big concern of mine is where, and this might not be answering your question directly, but I'm concerned about IPR and the response to what's going to happen in November. Seeing so many active cases right now, like, are we concerned that there's going to be like staff departures that could delay stuff even more? I'm just wondering how we narrow our focus and support IPR and also support just where we can have the most impact. And I'm not sure the answer of that right now. It was a little painful to hear Dana's response to the vote. And I know there are varying opinions in this group of that, but I'm a little concerned about that at a moment that we need IPR to be doing their job, like at the tip top shape with so many complaints coming in.
I'm still here. It's dark in my house now though, but just, you know, from the IPR perspective, I was probably a little emotional in my opening statements, but it is very much something that is very salient for the staff right now. But there is an overwhelming sense of commitment still from the investigators and from the staff in terms of, you know, making sure that we are still doing quality work and as timely as we can. I mean, there's what we're not going to be able to do is to get cases done any more quickly with the volume that we have. And I think that the vote was just, another kind of level of heaviness on top of the already, like, we're furloughed on different days and the workload and everything. But the investigators are amazingly still committed to, you know, doing this work and doing it well. I think that the one thing that will, you know, the November election is hanging over our heads. And so we will be working on some level on contingency planning. Like, if there is a yes vote in November, what does that mean for our work looking forward? And like I said earlier, I think that the question about whether, if the public votes yes, do they contemplate keeping the expertise of the IPR investigators and the analysts and everything, or do they contemplate, I mean, again, I've heard Commissioner Hardesty say explicitly that people who are in IPR would be welcome to reapply. So that implies that this contemplates an entire start over from scratch. And so I think that if there is a yes vote, then that question is something that we'll have to grapple with in November. But I think between now and November, we're kind of fine, but we'll just kind of be working on a little bit of what if. But, you know, I think hopefully that the caseload with the protests kind of dying down a little bit, the caseload will come back to a more normal place and we'll be able to, you know, reduce the backlog that we have right now. But the investigators and everything are really committed to doing as much as they can, as quickly as they can, without reducing quality and just like shoving things through the process willy-nilly. So I do want to make sure that people hear very clearly that the staff, while it it did hurt and it was painful. I think that it hasn't changed. People who do this work are committed to it, and it's hard work. And so people come to this with a sense of intentionality. And so they remain committed to that in a way that I think will continue to serve the city at least through November. And then we'll see what happens then.
And Dana, I just want to say that, you know, having now been on the CRC for about 3 years, the professionalism of IPR has been outstanding. All the staff that I've interacted with and how welcoming they've been when I first came on board, and how supportive everybody has been, and how professional our hearings are and the presentation from IPR and getting everybody on board and the support we're receiving is outstanding. It's been difficult on my end as well to see kind of how this process has gone. And, you know, I myself have been in a similar situation in a former job where in the federal government, like part of my section was redlined due to forces outside of our control, and everybody had to change job classifications, which, you know, we're all hardworking, and it certainly is demoralizing when something like that happens and all of a sudden you're like, okay, now what do I do? So I totally understand from my own experience, but also I would hope that if this does get passed, that everybody just moves into new roles. That would make the most sense, because everyone has been outstanding in my experience.
Thank you. That's helpful to hear. I'll pass that along to the staff as well.
I wonder if we could write a resolution to City Council. I mean, I guess maybe, I don't know if we wait until November, but like a recommendation for what happens in porting, like if like a recommendation from us of like, hey, we as the CRC would recommend hiring on IPR staff to the new, I think that would be, I mean, something we could do to help. Do we write resolutions?
Yeah, we definitely can. I mean, we write like press releases, and it's basically a resolution. I don't know. We, at least in my time, haven't really done that. But I don't think it's like not within our, like, I think we can do that. So I don't know if there's a precedent that I'm not aware of. If David has any history or context on that.
No, the CRC never done a resolution before.
So. Okay, good to know. But we have done press releases, which are, you know, our opinions, right? So we did that when we did the protest one. So I feel like it is the same impact. It's really just words that we want people to read and share our opinions on. So, Andy, were you going to add something there?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, one of the things we discussed at the retreat was, you know, the voice that we'll have as the CRC and what it looks like going forward. And I wonder, you know, if discussing that would fit in with, if we do have a place to make recommendations of what it looks like going forward, and we can make recommendations of what our role as the CRC is in the new regime, like we also, as part of that, can voice our opinion about IPR and IPR staff based on our experience with them and our interaction with them. So I think, you know, if we do have a voice in the reform, assuming it passes in November, that's another avenue that we can use to advocate for IPR.
Yeah, and I just want to call out the elephant in the room, because I know that people are thinking it, and I obviously set my testimony in strong support of the measure. I've been having a really difficult time talking about it, because on one end, of course, I participated in that due to my expertise and in of the CRC. You know, obviously I can't separate that. I can't put in my CRC brain and my Candace brain. I'm always bringing my experiences of the CRC into these spaces. But I participated on that committee as, you know, Candace, advocate, person who wants change. And so it was difficult. It was a really, you know, I went into those meetings, obviously determined to make sure that the CRC is understood and what we're doing, because I think that our systems, you know, they have really, we've worked on them, you know, even though people might be like, oh, they're all trash and they don't work. Actually, Portland has a a system that is better than many places. So that perspective is important. But I supported the change because I support strong progressive bold moves. I mean, that's just my personality, that I am. And but I'm naming this because it is really hard, because of course I care about the staff at IPR. I care a lot about what they do for us on the CRC. I understand the role that they play, and I was very active on, you know, making sure that that perspective was shared in these spaces. Because, and like, for example, feeling that, you know, IPR should be able to transfer into this new role. That really it's just like, let's take the frame and put everything that we have said we want from IPR and we want from the CRC and how the code is written to give us, you know, more authority and oversight and the ability to have a little bit more influence on the police. I went into that process feeling like that is that new casing, we all go into it. And I know that there's a lot left up in the air. I mean, yeah, even no matter what the vote is on November, if it is yes, I mean, it's not like everything just dissolves on November 4th, right? There's a process built in, there's an 18-month process. There's a lot that needs to be fleshed out. And I'm definitely fighting to make sure CRC's voice is reflected on that. And you know, that's something that others in that room were also fighting for, just for the record. So it's not like we're also alone and that people feel like, you know, we're not, they don't see value in what CRC is, what IPR is and does. So, you know, I obviously want, I want our systems to be successful. And I know that it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable. I don't know how to say it other than it's uncomfortable, because I have to constantly battle between these two sides of me where I'm like, yeah, I'm like with this side, you know, of like going the police ballot measure, but I'm not down with saying that like IPR is trash and they have no use. I don't agree with that. So I've just been in a difficult place sometimes, because of course many people have varying opinions on how police oversight and everything is going to look. And, you know, this is just an unprecedented moment where there was an opportunity, and it makes sense to me why people went for it. You know, there's politics involved and personalities involved and all of that. But I think that ultimately we do have a say in what's happening next. I'm going to make sure of it. And I would like us to, what we talked about at the retreat last week was like, you know, let's not maybe go down a route where we're just putting work that might be futile. I don't know how to say that word. And let's put it productively towards like helping with this new system, making sure that the good parts of our system transfer into the new one, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, there's a lot of unknowns, but I do want us to continue to support, you know, IPR and what they're doing. And that report that they put out today was a really good example of the great things that they, you know, do. And we want to continue to support that as the CRC. So those are just my thoughts. Just wanted to name that and say thank you to Dana for being amazing. And I know this is difficult. It's uncomfortable. I'm not gonna lie. We should have a virtual coffee so we can just check in.
Sure thing.
Or you could come to Tertulia. We miss you at Tertulia. We have a Spanish group that we talk in Spanish and eat lunch. So. Anyway, any other thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'd like to chip in. Good evening, everyone. I was listening over the phone and decided to finally hop online once my phone died. Great meeting this evening. I really enjoyed having an opportunity to listen in on the case. And, you know, I have to say, as one of the new members, Dana, I'll be following up to finish my training. So, you know, I can officially take part. But, you know, when I got involved, specifically, I was asked as part of Race Talks, not as Shayna Pomerantz, the individual, though I bring lots of good things to the table. But specifically, IPR, who has a relationship with our organization, said, hey, we need more folks of color. We need more community voices. We need more of that, you know? And so that's why I'm here. And that's who I represent when I show up. I represent the organization of Race Talks. I represent my community. I represent the people who signed off on my referrals. I represent my family who have been at this work for decades living in this community. And so one thing I would like to say, if there is something that we could collectively look to shift just in terms of how we talk about this work, is that even though we weren't elected to be here, we represent the citizens here. And I don't hear enough of us talking about the people we represent. And I would really like to hear that incorporated more so and bring the community members who aren't able to be here. I know we have folks who come consistently and take part and keep this work accountable, keep us accountable. And I think that's really important to have those folks coming, and the fact that they are also volunteering their time and committed to doing this. You know, I am excited for the changes. I know change is really, really uncomfortable. I know advocacy is important. I know there's a lot of organizations that are, you know, involved in doing this work with the PSEP and, you know, the advisory board that's, you know, the equity advisory board, I'm sorry, loss of words, with Portland Police Bureau. And so I guess if going back to your original question, Candace, in terms of, you know, where should the focus of our work be? Just kind of given all these changes, just understanding how IPR is working under time constraints and, you know, being a state employee myself and seeing a tremendous influx of work and, you know, trying to juggle the at-home dynamic coupled with, you know, everything else and not losing my mind on top of it. And still looking halfway presentable and sounding halfway coherent in the process too. I would say if we could try to maybe see if we can put some of the activism components in the lap of, you know, some of the other entities who are doing this work and maybe say, hey, this is where we're coming from. If there's something you need us to co-sign and show up on, you know, we're happy to be there, but maybe put the bulk of our attention into moving these cases through, especially since we have this really unique platform of doing it virtually right now. And so I think it would be really great if, even if we could promote more of the casework on our Facebook page, social media, to give people more understanding about what this CRC is. I can't tell you how many people are confused about the protocols. Everybody wants to defund police. I mean, I think we could have all kinds of conversations about what is what. I have family that's in law enforcement. I don't like a lot of the things that I see happening within law enforcement, but I love my family and I've had some great experience working with law enforcement. So I think you can be on both sides of this and still do this work and be in it. So I think, you know, if I had to advocate for us saying, let's limit the scale and focus of how we're coming at this work for this little period of time between now and, you know, until we get kind of the next set of directives and be as impactful as we can be, I think that would be really great. The other thing is knowing that every time we meet, the IPR team has to meet with us and kind of, you know, knowing that that takes away from, you know, whatever they're doing when we're not together. So I want to be really sensitive to that. And thank you, IPR, and Dana. I'm seeing Dana and David and Irene. I know I can be a pain in the butt, you know, asking all my questions and applying pressure. And, you know, I'm Donna Jr. It's what I do, but I respect you all and I'm committed to this work and this process. So please know that anything I say or do, it is with respect and with the intentionality of, you know, being transparent, being open, and making sure that we are advocating for community through this process.
Anyone else want to add? Okay, well, why don't we leave it at that for now? We'll keep talking offline about, you know, how we organize our work. We've got our two work groups coming up in 2 weeks, so I would say make that a high priority to talk about that in your work group meetings further, and make sure you have a clear path forward on how your work groups are going to adjust given all of this and what your priorities are going to be given all this. And then I know we still are having the issue. Jihan, are you the only one on recurring audit still?
No, the team has joined.
Oh, that's right, Vadim joined. Okay, cool. So for now, we'll go with that, and then we'll check in soon about how to move forward. Cool? Okay. Speaking of work groups, well, any other new or old business anyone wanted to bring up? Okay. Let's go into work group updates. So, recurring audit.
Gonna unmute myself there. So the recurring audit work group met in July, revised our mission statement with the help of several community members who were part of the meeting. I'm just trying to find here. The revised mission statement says, the recurring audit work group seeks to improve accountability of IPR and PPD by reviewing closed cases and other relevant data to ensure procedures, policies, and protocols are appropriate and followed, and that recommendations for improvements are made based on emerging evidence and analysis. The recurring audit work group will also work with other CRC work groups to develop policy recommendations for improvements. Obviously, we could have used a little more punctuation there, but I think you get the gist of it. We did not have the opportunity to talk about how we will move forward beyond the mission statement. So that will be the agenda for the next meeting, which is now set on a recurring basis. I want to say the fourth Wednesday of the month at 5:00. Vadim, is that correct? Or David?
Yes.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Jihan. Policy and outreach.
I don't know if Vadim is present. I've been out for a little bit. I missed the last one.
Vadim, are you ghosting us? Okay, we'll wait for Vadim to come back and then I'll give mine in the interim. Crowd control and use of force. Admittedly, we have not been able to get back around to fixing our mission statement because we've just been so caught up with the protests and then processing the work from the protests or the information from the protests. I didn't put it on today's agenda to give a presentation on it just because there was a lot going on with the agenda, but I do have it. We will have that ready to give a presentation on the rest of the rest of the committee on our findings what we learned, I guess, from that forum. Overall, I think that there were definitely the hiccups with the Zoom bombers, which is just super frustrating because, again, there's a glitch with the Zoom platform because I can't get rid of Zoom bombers once they're in breakout rooms. So that was just a nightmare. And I've been back and forth in emails with Zoom support and I'm just like, are you listening to me? Just add the button. Like, don't tell me anything else if you're not gonna add the button. So I feel like that's just a big barrier that we'll need to think about in the future because it really makes it hard at that point to do anything. I basically just had to sit in one of the rooms and continuously mute this guy who just would keep unmuting and being a jerk. So, that's a big thing, especially for folks that want to do forums, if any of the other work groups want to do forums, just if you're doing it in that format with breakout sessions, think about that. Another thing that I learned too is that once people are also not in the main room, they're in the breakout rooms, I can't make them co-hosts. So I had one facilitator that I thought I had made her a co-host. I think she'd like left the meeting because her internet went out, and when she came back, I didn't make her a co-host again. So then when it was her room that I had to sit in because I couldn't make her the co-host. And so then I had to like keep muting that guy. I mean, I could have made her the co-host by putting her back in the main room, but like it was a Hail Mary, you know. I was just like trying to make sure that, you know, it was crazy. So another thing to consider for future virtual forums. But other than those glitches, I thought it was productive. We got a lot of good information. The note takers did a really good job capturing what was said. And we're creating that PowerPoint, like I said, it's in our folder now, our public folder, so you can take a look at the progress on it. It's almost done. I just got to add some things that Barbara on our work group added, did some analysis on the survey that we also did, which collected over 100 responses. So we'll make sure everybody gets access to that. And that would be a great thing to also bring. The reason I have it in presentation format too is because it's easy to present, obviously. That would be a great thing to bring to your meetings with the commissioners. To just say, hey, we did this forum, here are the basics that we learned, because they are always wanting to know what we're up to, you know, and that's a good thing to let them know. We are meeting in 2 weeks, and we will continue to, a big focus, I think, is gonna be us talking about what's our next steps with crowd control use of force policy. You know, even it has its like, kind of makes sense because it's like, you could address policy of the future CRC, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know what role crowd control use of force will have, but we'll need to discuss that. Thanks, Dana. Bye. No, I'm hungry too, Dan. We need to end this so I can go eat some food. Vadim, are you back? That's it for crowd control. Are you back, Vadim? He ghosted us. I knew it. Well, I did go to the meeting, but I don't remember what we did. Who else was there? Was it just me and Vadim? I feel like it.
I was there too. They all kind of are running together a little bit on me. So, yeah.
Well, I think the update is that one thing we did discuss was who to outreach to at one point. I'm also, the meetings are blending. I don't know if that was the last meeting for the last CRC meeting or the most recent one. I don't know. But ultimately, I think the big goal is to build a connection also with other groups that are doing policy work. And that's a big thing we talked about at the CRC retreat. So I'm sure that's going to be on the agenda. And if it's not, please, Adam, put it on the agenda for next time.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. I did reach out to Commissioner Hardesty's office. Taylor, in response to your email, no, I haven't. I mean, I've talked to Commissioner Hardesty separate and apart, but I know she doesn't necessarily do the scheduling. So I, you know, just let her know that the email was submitted when we spoke, but, you know, just waiting for it. So if I don't hear back, then I'll send something this week to follow up, because I imagine they're getting lots of communication right now.
Yeah, I was about to say, part of that email is like, I bet she's very busy, but
I would send it to Lynn directly if you can.
Oh, I do. I always communicate with Lynn. I think the next step is we might just text her. So, yeah.
And then, yeah, for other folks with other commissioners, definitely CC their assistant or scheduler, whatever their titles are, in your emails, because I'm sure that will get you a faster response. All right, moving through the agenda, we are at public comment, unless there's anything else anyone wants to bring up on the CRC. All right, we're going to move into public comment. So again, if you would like to comment, raise your hand, and I have Mr. Thomas first. You are up.
Oh, hi. I couldn't hear you call on me because you were breaking up. This is Dan Handelman again with Portland Cop Watch. And I just want to say, I also wrote in the chat at the beginning, I'm also with Flying Focus Video Collective, and I have been recording your meetings off the screen. And in the future, as you have appellants who come on who may not want to use their name or might be shy about having their picture taken, it would be helpful for me to know if you can ask them if they're okay with flying focus recording their voice or image, because I can't talk to them in person as I used to be able to when we weren't under COVID. To the comments about your meeting, I think the staff straightened this out for you, but you know, the whole thing about the conference hearing is that it should never have existed, really, that the IPR director put that in place. The original ordinance said if the chief disagrees with CRC, this hearing goes to city council. And the IPR put this step in as kind of a interim step, and it's part of why we have a Byzantine system, because it keeps coming back and keeps coming back. So if the chief had agreed with you tonight, then great. If he, you know, had disagreed with you tonight, then as you already did, schedule the city council. But there's no need to ask them to come back a third time. In terms of the transition to this new board, if the vote goes through, I sent you all the information we sent to city council about, and I also brought this up at your retreat, that the old review board before you existed, PIAC, worked right up until the last minute when CRC was implemented. They actually helped design how to pick the members of the CRC. And some members transitioned from one to the other. I'm hoping, and I understand that what you're saying about it's hard to work when you think that your job might end at any time, but it's going to take a year to a year and a half after that vote to set something up. I really hope you do follow through on encouraging everybody on council. And I heard three members of council say that they think that IPR needs support until this new system's in place. I think you have to keep encouraging them to follow through on that. The policy that you were talking about tonight was, according to the website, revised in early 2019. It actually was up for review in January of the year that this happened to the appellant, but we didn't comment on it that year. It didn't seem like a very important issue at the time, but now we know the problems with it. Recommendations of work groups are supposed to come back to the CRC. I don't remember what I wasn't quite sure what the comment that Mr. Mazursky was making, but if you look at the work group protocol, it says that any policy coming out of the work group has to come back to the full CRC. One of the things that is also up for review right now is a policy about the Brady rule, where if an officer is not credible, they're not allowed to testify in court. And that is a result of IPR's work on that. You probably read in the paper that the report came out in 2017, and the policy is only just being created now, 3 years later, which is, the wheels of justice grind way too slowly. And my final recommendation is that the recurring audit work group was trying to figure out exactly what to look at. The compliance officer who reviews the DOJ agreement reviewed 20 cases randomly among the different kinds of cases IPR handles, and they agreed every 100% that they were all based on preponderance of the evidence. Well, we don't trust the compliance officer because he's not from Portland. And we would like to see those same 20 cases handed to the recurring audit work group. That way you can do your own review and see if the compliance officer knows what they're talking about. Thank you very much for your time. And please, I do encourage you all to keep working right up until the very end.
Thank you, Mr. Handelman. And according to PSF 5.12, it says in number 4, all work group proposals and recommendations shall be presented to CRC at a regularly scheduled meeting for full discussion and approval. So I would say that checks out as far as you all needing to come back with a proposal, and it will need a full vote. Debbie Iona, you are next.
Hi, Debbie Iona, League of Women Voters of Portland. I just wanted to kind of reiterate this concern about what happens to IPR in the interim here when we don't know what the vote will be in November, and we don't know what will happen after that. But we encouraged City Council to give this commission that could be created to work out the new system the permission to talk about incorporating some of the best features of the system that we have now, because you do have a lot of strengths in your system, and also you know, think about incorporating and bringing the staff in to the through the transition and CRC members. And so I hope that, you know, we really do hope that the whatever this commission is, assuming the vote passes in November, will think about that, because I think that there'll be more continuity, smoother transition if we do something like that. And we pointed to the difficulties that Oakland is having getting its brand new system started. And we might be able to avoid those pitfalls by, you know, building on the strengths of what we have right now. And then the second comment I want to make, I know I've seen in a document from the auditor's office this idea that it's more important for CRC to work on policy issues and maybe the appeal hearings aren't so important, but I thought tonight was a perfect illustration of what kind of contribution the appeal hearings make to the policy discussion. Because when you're grappling with these things that that are related to flaws in the policy, you really can see firsthand what needs to be fixed. And so I definitely, you know, we think that the appeal hearings are important, not only for the policy aspects, but also feel that they serve the complainants, the appellants well. They really feel like they're being heard by their fellow community members, and also think that they're great for the public, for the community, people like the League and other organizations and individuals who are interested in getting sort of a little bit of an inside view about what happens. So so we certainly think that idea of having CRC not do appeal hearings is really not the best way to go. Okay, thank you very much. And thanks for, you know, your really thoughtful consideration of this case tonight.
Thank you, Ms. Ayana. Any other folks want to speak? Now is the time to raise your hand or post it in the chat. Okay. Oh, Taylor, go ahead.
I was just curious, a survey from the non-new members, the older members, is that kind of what to expect from an appeal hearing in the future? Or was that weird because of the posture that it was in, where it was?
Well, I mean, the appeal hearing's gonna have like more steps to it, because when you do the appeal, for example, the first step you have to do is decide if there was enough information and if there's enough in the case that you feel you can move forward to make a decision. So that you have to get through that step first, and that takes like a vote and everything. And then you go into the appeal hearing where you hear from command staff, you hear from the appellant, you hear from IPR, from us, and then have the discussion and then a vote. So it's a little bit more, there's more steps to it. But that concept of like being able to talk back and forth and, you know, say, oh, well, I read it this way, or I think that way about it, or, you know, share openly your thoughts so that to help other people in the committee grapple with the question at hand, that's definitely, yeah, the style of appeals.
There's more factual detail. Right now, we kind of skipped over a lot of things and focused on the main issues from the last hearing, but during a normal hearing, you'll have more information about what was said and the documents and what information was provided to the investigators and things like that.
Yeah.
I do have a question, maybe it's for David. How early do we get the case typically? So right now I have just this one case on my list, but I know we have others coming up.
So I have all the appeal case ready to go, so I can give you access as soon as tomorrow morning.
Sweet. I think that'd be great.
Yep.
So when's the next one going to be heard so I can make sure I'm positioned to be?
The next one is September 2nd. So there can be one every month all the way until November.
Okay.
And is Shayna on the schedule to be confirmed by city council?
She is confirmed, but she still have to go through the training.
I think I have one more hour of training. Yeah. I've done like three to, I don't know. Okay. It's all blending together.
Okay.
So we'll work it out with Dana. We've been doing it remotely since we were supposed to have an afternoon plan prior to COVID, and then COVID hit. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I just have one more question, just based on kind of the workflow. If we were to set up meetings based for the hearings, would it be a stretch for us to try to hear more than one a month, I mean, I'm like wanting to hit myself even as I say it, but I'm just kind of hearing the backlog, and 1 a month just sounds so like not a lot.
Well, we kind of talked about that last week, and it seemed like, I mean, I know somebody has suggested, it's obviously not, can't do it right now, but the concept of like, if there's more people on the CRC and then some people come 1 week, month or one, you know, and I know it was suggested like in general, like if only a quorum shows up, right, and people decide, I don't know. I mean, since we have this, all I know is doing it once a month, everybody shows up, you know, and so I'm totally open to if people want to do them more, but it's a lot of work. So that's totally up to y'all. If we feel like you have capacity to do a work group meeting and to appeal hearings, because it takes so much of that back work, you know, to read everything and hear all the audio and all that. So I think that's still up in the air. I don't know that, I mean, we don't need to make that decision right now, but we can definitely talk about it. But does anybody want to comment on that now?
I personally, just being new and seeing kind of how the structure, I know, Jahani, what's your work group? The mandatory, is that the auditor?
Bring audit.
So, I mean, I feel like with the exception of the mandatory work group, you know, I'd be down to segue from the other work groups into figuring out, do we all need to be present for an appeal hearing, or can, as you were saying, you know, quorum sufficient, you know, or even putting ourselves on sign up, you know, that could allow us potentially to hear more cases and spread it out. Just trying to think how we can be effective as well as try to engage more community in terms of being able to be part of this process and seeing how it works. So as we gear up for November, people have a better understanding of the work that we do here. I think tonight was a prime example of hearing policy recommendations. The officer wasn't present. I mean, those types of things were actually in the proposal. So being able to kind of juxtapose what's being proposed versus what's in practice and seeing it and being able to have real tangible conversation about what we do would be great.
Anyone else have thoughts on that? And also to clarify, are you saying maybe not having a work group meeting and instead replacing it with an appeal? Yeah.
With the exception of the mandatory work group. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I'll just throw this out there. What do people think if we were gonna meet on the first and third week of every month and we were gonna have an appeal on each of those meetings? Is that something people would be willing to do?
We only have three appeals on the docket, right? Am I missing something? I feel like there isn't this huge backlog just yet. There's three.
Yeah, we have three pending right now, yes.
Right. That's true.
On top of this
one. IPR, but not for CRC.
Yeah.
Because we don't know how many of whatever IPR is doing will become a CRC appeal.
That will take years. I mean, this is going to be probably next year when we get those appeal. But for now, we have three.
Got it. Yeah, that's important to remember. Yes. So maybe for now, not as big of a deal, but we could think about it in the future. Any other comments or thoughts? Okay. Well, then we are adjourned at 8:42 p.m. Thanks, everyone.